Professor Borg, Criminal Procedure Class, 18th November, number 6, room number 230.
Yeah. Anybody know how to turn this thing off? Oh, well. So, I guess if I wanted the spotlight, here I am. Any questions? I turned on the lights, supposedly, but they don't seem to be doing anything. They're all in the up position, but nothing's happening. And I even turned this off, and it's not turning off, but... Please wait. Hey! No. It's still on. Okay, folks, so, any questions? No? Yes?
With the atomic declaration, the atomic declaration...
I can't hear you. Especially if we're speaking in the dark. What?
The Atomic Declaration was supposed to only be in relation to the reason why he's dying. If he says that something totally different, it's not admissible.
Correct. It is not admissible. The only issue that a dying declaration is admissible for. Hold on a minute. Let's see if this thing that says on. Some success, except the lights aren't turning on. Okay, folks, the answer is it's limited purpose. Okay, now, no questions about the hearsay that we've been discussing? Nothing about the admission, co-conspirator statement, unavailability, a dying declaration? Oh, well, we're discussing declarations against interest then. Which is where we are. And now, the idea of a declaration against interest, success, is reflected in the nature of the rule. Why is it reliable? Why is a declaration against interest reliable? Well, it's reliable because it has to be so far against your personal interest when you say it, that in our understanding of psychology, nobody would say that unless they didn't have a choice, and not having a choice means it's true. Right? So that's an indicia of reliability. Now, so far against what? Penal, proprietary, pecuniary interest. That's been that already, right? Same thing, exactly what I said last class. Now, I pointed out that the indicia of reliability means that the focus is on the time at which the statement is made, not later on when there's a trial. And statements can be made long before there's any thought of the litigation, which is why the farmer's statement about using the field as long as they use it for a school is the perfect example of a statement that's so far against your interest. It's not 100% totally against your interest, but at the time you make it, no rational person would say it unless they believed it was true. Now, decades later, when the school building they use it for is now too old and they want to knock it down, well, now we have a statement that turns out to be in the interest of the speaker at the time of the litigation. But for reliability and admissibility purposes, we don't care about litigation time. We care about speaking time, because that's what makes it reliable. So think of it this way. It's like the red car went through the red light. The red car went through the red light, and that's it. It went through the red light. It went through the red light. It was a negligent act. It's done. It is. Correct? Well, if I made a declaration against interest, it's done. I made it. It is. At the time I made it, period. And now anybody who finds out about it, who chooses to use it in court, can get that statement admitted with, of course, one caveat. What's the caveat? You can never can get a dying declaration in. You never can get a declaration against interest into evidence unless 804A. The declarant is unavailable, right? Has to be unavailable, or it can't be admitted. That's a predicate, unavailability. And don't forget that, that's why I come back to it. It is very tempting to write some kind of exam question where it just reeks of declaration against interest, but there's no fact to suggest that the declarant is unavailable, and every people say, oh, declaration against interest, that's wrong, not admissible as a declaration against interest. And if the question is, you know, what is the basis for your objection here, and you don't say unavailability, so you have to remember for these three, declaration against interest, dying declaration, and past recorded testimony, unavailability has to be proven. Right? Okay. Back to the declaration against interest. Now, I pointed out that even though my example is the perfect example of how you look at the point of time in which the statement is made to determine whether or not it's against interest, times change, number one. But statements sometimes are ambiguous. And that's when I move to what I ended the class with, which is, well, let's see. You lent me $1,000. I paid you $1,000. So now I owe you $1,000. Now, is that statement admissible as a declaration against interest? Now, it certainly is a declaration against interest in the sense that the speaker, the declarant, admitted owing $1,000. But since the declarant also claimed a reduction in debt by having paid $1,000, it's in your interest and against your interest at the very same time. In your interest, against your interest, very same time. Now, how do you deal with that? And I told you the book has this wonderful little hypo, talking to the cop after an accident. No, I'm not drunk, I only had six beers. And so the question is, how do you decide if statements which are in your interest and against your interest at the very same time, whether or not they should be admissible as declarations against interest? So, the standard the court used derives from the language so far against your interest that you wouldn't say it unless it's true. And what they tend to do in the majority of jurisdictions, and this is a large majority, they look to the purpose of the declarant choosing to speak. Why was the statement made? Was the statement made, in my $1,000 case, was the statement made to reiterate the owing of $1,000? Or was the statement made to lock in the checkoff of $1,000? Everybody understand what I mean? Why did the guy speak? Was his interest having everybody aware of the fact that he paid off $1,000, or was his interest making sure that everybody knew he owed $1,000? And even if it's owed only $1,000, that wouldn't matter because the interest was in identifying how much he owed. Therefore, what tends to happen in statements that are both in and against your interest, instead of looking at the actual words that were said, one tends to look at the entire situation to determine how they came to be said. And that's what we're dealing with in Cole versus Cole, Barrera versus Gonzalez, this is 605-606, which are the statements that are both in and out of the jurisdiction. Now, in and out of your interest at the very same time. Now, I actually tried a case that I lost in the Second Circuit on this issue. And it seems to me that my position was right and their position was wrong. But what I mean by that is, I think if we seriously look at what we mean by against your interest and why a statement against interest is reliable, I think that you see that the purpose of speaking statement, that test, really isn't an appropriate test. Because what that does is that looks at the entire expression and does not focus on the part of the expression that's against interest and ask whether that part is so far against your interest that you wouldn't say it. And it seems to me if you do that, and for instance you take the ridiculous statement, no, I'm not drunk, I only had six beers, to the cop after an automobile accident, you see what I'm talking about. It is obvious the purpose of that statement in this somewhat demented guy's mind, I guess he was drunk or he wouldn't have said it, is to explain how he's not drunk. However, even if he, remember the good old Born versus Menlock from Torts, who didn't understand about spontaneous combustion, even though people told him over and over again because he was really stupid? Even if this guy is really stupid, I don't think there is somebody dumb enough to realize that telling a cop that you have been drinking alcohol before driving might not be a good idea. Which means if your purpose in speaking is to get yourself out of trouble, and in the effort to get yourself out of trouble, you are compelled to admit something that you know is an admission that isn't good for you in helping you get out of trouble, it seems to me that's the most reliable kind of statement against your interest. I know that telling this cop that I've been drinking is bad, but I guess I reek of alcohol so much I gotta tell him I've been drinking something, which means what? Which means that the six beer statement is highly likely to be false, because the guy had to have drunk more if he would have admitted to drinking six. I mean, who's going to say six? I mean, it must have had 12 or 14 beers over the day if he's going to identify six. That's a lot to admit to a cop. He didn't say one, he didn't say two. It has to be what? At least six. I mean, the most reliable thing I can imagine is that kind of statement. When you concede something because you have to try to get a benefit. But the courts, minority of courts look at it that way, but the majority of courts say it doesn't matter what you conceded, the question is the purpose of making the statement. Because it's an overall analysis. If your mental state was to get yourself out of trouble, that means whatever you say is not reliable. Because you're trying to help yourself, and everybody knows everybody stretches the truth. We don't say lies, right? Stretches the truth to get themselves out of trouble. So anyhow, you have the minority rule, which looks at the part of the statement that's against interest, and the majority rule that looks at the purpose of making the statement. But this part in and part out is a continuing problem, and be aware that you want to deal with it, because it happens more often than you think, to repeat for the final time, because people don't carefully choose their words to decide what matches some evidence rule of admissibility one way or the other. We later on have to go chop up the statement to see how it fits to these rules. Yes?
According to the minority rule that we think is a part of the statement against interest, how is that to reconcile with an implicit statement? When it comes to admissions,
no.
You can't chop it up.
Good question. We chop it up to determine whether or not the part of the statement that the party wants to offer is admissible, but we admit the whole thing, but the relevant part is, I owe you $1,000, or the relevant part is, I had six beers. So we'll admit the whole thing, but we admit it because the part that is relevant is, in fact, reliable.
How do we know if it's a minority or majority rule?
Well, you know, it's the minority rule because the majority rule that most states follow is that they look at the purpose for which the statement is made. And if you're going to apply a rule, how do you put it this way? In a real world, you're going to look it up. But for our world, if you're asking what you should apply on the test, it's the majority rule. Now, next topic here in this Declaration Against Interest is presented by the Carpenter versus Davis case. And this is this wonderful thing, yes, I know, it's not your fault. Yes, I know, it's not your fault. And the question is, when you admit in a personal injury scenario that the accident was not the other guy's fault, what are you saying? Are you saying, you pulled right out in front of me, yes, I know, it's not your fault? Well, are you admitting that you pulled out in front of them? Or are you as an understanding person saying, it was my fault, it wasn't your fault? Now, If you are adopting the statement, you pull that right in front of me, yes, I pull that right in front of me, well, that is a declaration against interest, and it's against your pecuniary interest, because at that point, a lawsuit for damages is clearly foreseeable, and no one would make a statement identifying the fact that they're responsible for injuries unless they felt that they had to. Hold on a minute before the question. Okay, remember the question, John. Now, the problem with this, however, is that that may not be what the speaker was intending. The speaker may not have been saying, yes, I pull that in front of you. The speaker may have been saying, yes, I understand that you didn't do anything wrong. And that is problematic, because we have negligence and contributory negligence, correct? So the defendant may well have put that right in front of the speeding defendant. So it wasn't all the fault of the puller-outer, right? It was both of their faults. And the problem presented in the Carpenter case is not only one of somewhat foolish linguistic analysis, if you look at all the judges, but also it's a question of what you do with declarations against interest as to legal rights and opinions, which are considered different than facts. Now, John?
Wouldn't the statement of the woman be barred anyway under the dead man's rule if it's a state court that had this rule?
Well, obviously, this is not a problem in their dead man statute. Because remember, every dead man statute is written differently. So it's a good thing to check out, but the fact that we have pages of this thing, and though dead man means the way the Missouri dead man statute is written, this did not violate. Good to think of it, though. Now, so what do we do with that? Well, the first thing this tells you, and I mean, you've got three dissenting judges here and a majority opinion, and none of them disagree on the legal rule. Most of them disagree on how you decode the statement. I mean, what did the yes mean? What did it adopt? What does "it's all my fault" mean? And then the legal consequences flow, which is terrific, because what it points out is that linguistic analysis is a tool of trial lawyers who are attempting to gain or block admission of evidence. Evidence is often words people said. And if you try to get it in, recognizing that there may be ambiguity in the meaning, is something you have to deal with. And if you want to keep it out, the claim of ambiguity is almost a first recourse. But if we don't know what the guy said, obviously the prejudice is much greater if it's ambiguous, because it can be misinterpreted by the jury. And also, of course, it may fit into or not fit into the categories that we need to apply to create admissibility. Now, declaration against interest, a declaration against proprietary, an example, the ownership of property, against pecuniary, in terms of I owe you $1,000, I don't owe you $1,000. This problem with legal conclusions, it's all my fault, which renders them inadmissible. And now we go to a sort of the statement part in and part out. But now we go to People versus Brown, which happens to be a New York case from getting close to 40 years ago. And this deals with what the law considered to be a special problem. And we basically don't think of it as so special anymore. Attitudes have changed. And this is the declaration against penal interest. Not proprietary, not pecuniary, penal interest. And the question, of course, is, why is this statement considered different? And indeed, in common law, in many jurisdictions, declarations against penal interest were not admissible as declarations against interest. The first question, the first reason is they're stubborn. After all, a declaration against penal interest is, I set the house on fire, I robbed the bank, I killed the person, I raped them, I mugged them, right? I mean, the declarant is scum. Which means that if you're thinking in terms of what makes a statement reliable, a declaration against penal interest, almost by definition, is a statement by a person who's claiming at least some aspect of unreliability. I have a character flaw. I committed crime. So that made problems. And I'd say not so much anymore, but certainly created problems in the sense that what we're now going to do, and don't forget this, this is all hearsay, right? This is exceptions to the hearsay rule. We're introducing Charlie's statement that he robbed the bank as evidence in this case, and Charlie is not here. Correct? Because if Charlie were here, we could introduce this as declaration against interest. This leads to this sort of aura of unreliability, leads to looking more closely at declarations against penal interest. Declarations against penal interest can and mostly are offered in two different scenarios. The first is by a prosecution. The second is by the defendant. Now, when I say it's offered by the prosecution, you're probably thinking of the defendant said he robbed the bank, and the prosecutor is offering the defendant's statement that he robbed the bank against the defendant. No, that would be an admission. Correct? That's not it. There we don't need to deal with declarations against interest and unavailability and reliability at the time it was said. That's an admission, any comment. So we would be talking about introducing my statement that I robbed the bank as evidence to show that John was guilty of robbing the bank. Correct? That's what we're going to talk about, right? I mean, if we're talking about introducing a statement that I robbed the bank as a declaration against interest, then it has to be offered against somebody other than me by the prosecution, which means it's going to be offered by the prosecution against a co-defendant. And if I'm not charged, like because I'm dead, offered against the defendant. But when the prosecutor offers it, it's offered against somebody other than the declarant. That's why it's a declaration against interest, not an admission. Now, the other scenario when it's offered in favor of the defendant. And let's start with that one, in favor of the defendant. This means that I, who am charged with this bank robbery, are going to be able to call a witness who talked to John a year ago and wants to tell the jury today that John told the witness that John had robbed the bank. Right? Yeah, I was talking to John and he said he robbed the bank. Yeah. John is scum, right? John isn't here, and this is offered to create a reasonable doubt that I didn't do it, that John did it instead of me, correct? Now, how reliable is John's statement? Well, we start out with he's scum, so it's not very reliable because of the declarant. But we also start out with something else. A declaration against interest is not necessarily a declaration against penal interest, even if it's against your penal interest. Declaration against penal interest may not be against your penal interest, even though it's against your penal interest. I like that. Hope you remember it. Why? Well, there's a thing called concurrent sentences. So, if I'm charged with three bank robberies, admitting that I committed two more, four and five, is highly unlikely to cause me to spend a second more in jail. In fact, I may even have a good time because instead of keeping me up in Dannemora, which is not a nice place to be, they might bring me back to New York where I can see my family while I get go on trial for these new crimes. And I'm going to get a concurrent sentence. I mean, I already get 20 years and I'm 55 years old. I mean, then I've got to bother with more sentence. You get the idea? So sometimes it's against your interest, but it really isn't. Sometimes it's so little against your interest, even though it's totally against your interest, They don't even care about prosecuting. I mean, waste of time to bring me down from Dannemora to try me for another bank robbery or two when everybody knows I'm going to get concurrent time. I mean, so why are they even going to bother? So it's theoretically against my penal interest because no one's even going to prosecute because of my particular circumstances. Then we have another kind of situation, represented, of course, by the life sentence or the death penalty. I have already been sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Is it possible for me to make a declaration against my penal interest? I have the maximum penalty. I've already been sentenced to be executed. I got the maximum penalty. What else can they do? And indeed, in the book but not the movies of The Godfather, if you remember, they have trouble getting the guy back from Italy because he killed the cop. And as the families make up after their war, one of the things that one of the families does is has one of their members who's on death row admit to having been the one who killed the cop. So the police are no longer looking for the guy who killed the cop. And what's his name? Michael can come back from Sicily and run the families for the next 7 hours of movie because they got it back. But the point is, there's a declaration against penal interest, right? I killed this police captain. Nothing can happen to the guy. Now, that's declarations against penal interest offered to exculpate. But I'm not even putting into situations where they don't have enough evidence to corroborate, because one of the areas in which many jurisdictions require corroboration is a confession. You can't be convicted on your confession alone. There may be no corroboration. What about the statement offered by the prosecutor? Well, here's the problem with that. Anybody ever spend any time at all thinking about the nature of the negotiation in a criminal case? What does the defendant have to offer? What does the prosecution want? Thinking about that, maybe. Well, generally, what the defendant has to offer that the prosecution wants is two things. One is certainty of conviction. So, I agree to plead guilty. They have certainty of conviction, which of course means that, you know, my scummy body isn't going to get out of jail for a number of years. And they don't have to spend the time and energy to try the case and take the risk of losing. But they also want something else. And nowadays, they often want this part even more. What they want is information about other bad guys. They want me to create cases for them. They want me, in other words, to cooperate. Now, if you think about that for a minute, if I am a first-timer, this is the only bank I ever robbed, and I don't know anybody else to rob the bank, I'm in trouble in the cooperation front, correct? I don't have anything to give them. I can't help them make cases. I can't testify against people. I'm in real trouble. So what might I do? Yeah? Well, I might be able to work as an informant, but I can't get into a group of criminals if they don't know me already here either.
You're going to make it up.
Yeah. Don't I have an incentive to make it up? In other words, in the cooperation business, the worse I am, the better it is for me. The more I have to offer them, the better. The more I have to offer them, the happier they are with me. And if I really, really have a lot to offer them against really, really bad guys, I might wind up living in Duluth, Minnesota on the witness protection plan with a new name and new identity, and I might not go to jail at all. If I really have a lot to give them. So, assuming I'm smart, And assuming there isn't anybody who just walked in one day and robbed the bank and never knew anybody with anything, what do I do? Well, I sort of find out what they expect me to know. And I agree with them. Oh, you must have robbed it. Who was involved? Did this guy? Was it? Oh, yeah, they were involved. Absolutely. I mean, you know, anybody they want to know, yup. Now, that doesn't mean it happens every day. But the point is, the declaration against interest, when I take responsibility for committing a crime, in a scenario when somebody who may have been my cellmate or otherwise is a friend or associate of mine is going to get free because of that, is rife with problems because it may really not be against my interest because of the nature of criminal prosecution and sentencing. On the other hand, the statement offered by the government to implicate somebody else, the theory being Kessler says he did it, well, Kessler was there doing it, well, that means the guy we can prove who was with Kessler half an hour earlier, and when Kessler said he did it, that tends to be proof that the guy he was with half an hour was the guy he was with at the crime, correct? So it's circumstantial evidence that the other guy did because of other proof of association with Kessler. So that's also suspicious in many circumstances. So both ways, these declarations against penal interest are less against penal interest than the, you know, I owe you $1,000. Which, by the way, has some problems if Michael Jordan says it, because after all, I assume, you know, 6'7", he might not bother stooping to pick up $1,000. He has so much money. I mean, Bloomberg, at some point, the amount of money that's money to us is meaningless. So maybe it is a declaration against his interest to say he owes you $1,000. But that's a different kind of problem. This area is feeling more acute. Now, what essentially happened to this issue in the 60s is our attitudes changed, and we felt that we couldn't really distinguish between declarations against one kind of interest, declarations against another kind of interest, because after all, if I admit to knocking you over the head and rendering unconscious, I have admitted to committing a tort which I can be civilly liable and I'm going to have to pay you money. And to say, oh, no, because that's a crime, it's not a tort, well, it's really sort of cutting things pretty narrowly. Or to say it's offered in a criminal rather than a civil case, and therefore it shouldn't be recognized as declaration against interest, doesn't seem to make much analytic sense. So what happened is that the distinctions between the different kinds of against interest disappeared over time. However, when we take a look in a declaration against penal interest in the federal rules of evidence, and take a look, for instance, at Wilson versus U.S., which is a Supreme Court case with a variety of concurrences and different decisions, and goes on others. What we have is the text to deal with. Now, the text makes a distinction in the declaration against penal interest, because between declarations against penal interest and all other declarations against interest, and most particularly the declaration against penal interest that's offered by the defendant to establish that somebody else did it. And that is identified as a specially risky type of statement. And in that scenario, only corroboration is required. So, if you remember, John said he did it, and I want to prove John did it to get myself off. And we're calling somebody who John talked to because John's not available. Well, in that situation, when I'm offering the statement, John said he robbed the bank, as proof that Kessler did not rob the bank, that statement has to be corroborated. Now, this leads to, if you will, something that was bruited about as a constitutional due process violation. The court sort of were able to circumvent the constitutional problem. So let me identify the problem, identify how it got circumvented. I actually tried a case. And in this case, there was a very sleazy con man, I may have told you about it, whose name was Cohn. And he figured out how banks create the codes that they use when they do wire transfers. And this is before everything was done computer, and there was a different code and they changed it on a weekly basis. And he figured this out. And this guy was probably at the time 55, short, plump, boiled, bald. And, I mean, he could speak. And the way he figured out, by the way, was he dated women who worked in the various wire transfer for departments of different banks, and he got from each of them a little part of the code so they weren't suspicious. He put it together. So he was really sharp, and it never worked a day in his life. Had entirely spent his life living most of the time quite affluently when he wasn't in jail on various types of funds. But now, to do a wire transfer, illegally, you need two things. You need a bank account to which you know the number out of which the money is going to come. You need the code, and you need a bank account into which the money is going to go. Correct? Now, the way you get the bank account, of course, to take the money from is you convince wealthy people that you're a wealthy person and they trust you and that you get involved with some transactions with them. Eventually, it's because you're so chatty and so friendly and so wealthy, they tell you bank account numbers. However, you can't transfer it into your bank, right? If you transfer it into your bank account, sooner or later, the person will notice the money is gone. It'll trace right back to you. You're dead. So you have to find somebody into whose account to put the money. So that's what Cohn did. Then they got arrested. And the people who hung out with him didn't come to jail and visit him enough. So he told the government that they were involved in the scheme also. And I represented a guy named Bob who, IQ was probably in double digits maybe, because he got that high. Very nice guy, but I mean, really grim. And Cohn said, my guy Bob did this particular wire transfer. Now, it's impossible to, would have been sophisticated to do it enough, even if the guy told him. But nonetheless, that was the testimony. Bob didn't visit him enough in jail. And there was a nominee. The nominee was named John. And John happened to have a heart problem and was in a hospital in Pennsylvania. And sort of got out in the back. Really was not going to be able to travel to New York to testify. So the United States attorney, who was handling the prosecution, called this guy up and interviewed him on the telephone and wrote down the statement. And what he said was, in my view, the equivalent of, I only had 6 beers. Yes, I got the money from Cohn, but I didn't know anything was wrong. And what he did, by the way, was, he got $50,000 transferred into an account and immediately gave Cohn $25,000 because that's what Cohn would do. You see, oh, you need $25,000 for that business, and I understand, well, I'll tell you, I'll loan you the money, I really trust you, but it's more convenient, I'll put it in 50, you give me that $25, you keep doing $25, is that all right? Of course it's all right, you just got $25,000 for having to sign a piece of paper. But I didn't know there's anything wrong. Well, the guy isn't available at trial, and we try to offer it into evidence. There are two legal problems. With my effort to get the statement in, I got the money from Cohn, not Bob. Cohn. Bob's last name is Quavis, by the way. So I got the money from Cohn, no mention of Quavis. But I didn't know there's anything wrong. Two problems. Right? Two problems. You should know one of them right now. Because I spent 10 minutes talking about it. Come on, what's one? Somebody. What's one problem with getting that admitted? As a declaration against interest. Yeah?
Well, it may not really be a declaration against interest.
Absolutely. Why? Because he said he got the money from Cohn against his interest because he knows Cohn is the bad guy, but he said, I didn't do anything wrong. 6 beers, right? Exactly right. That's one problem. Second problem.
Competition
clause? No. It's not confrontation. We'll get to Crawford, but no, it's not confrontation. Corroboration. I just talked about corroboration. If I'm going to get this statement in to show that Cohn did not Quavis, it has to be corroborated. Right? So first, I get it kind of over Reader's problem, which is the prosecution said, this is entirely in his interest. Right? He was saying he didn't do anything wrong. That's why he was speaking. I'm busy arguing, but wait a minute. He admitted getting $50,000 from Cohn, who he knows was defrauding people at the time he spoke. So he would never admit that if he didn't get it from Cohn. Well, big problem, right? Correct? Now, second, corroboration. I corroborated it by proving that Cohn was doing this stuff. I corroborated it by showing that Cohn and the guy who's now in the hospital met together at a party. Wasn't enough corroboration. Corroboration is difficult because there's really nothing precise about it. So I didn't get this in for two reasons. And I'm really annoyed because I think it's really reliable. And I know my guy couldn't possibly have done it because he's too stupid. But you can't prove that in court. So I said to myself, what about raising a constitutional argument attacking the corroboration requirement? Because it's only one-sided. The defendant introducing this guy's statement that he got the money from Cohn, the defendant offering it to show that Cohn, not Quavis, was guilty, has to corroborate. But I ask myself, what happened if the defendant on trial had been Cohn? Not Quavis, Cohn. Now, in the real world, he's already been convicted, but what happened if his Cohn was on trial? And the government finds this guy who's in the hospital in Pennsylvania who said, I got the money from Cohn. He's unavailable. It's a declaration against his penal interest. They would not have to corroborate. Still, I read this question, and maybe it's not against the penal interest, but the point is, they wouldn't have to corroborate. Because corroboration applies when you're offering the statement to exculpate, that is, to get somebody off. And when the prosecutor is using it, it's not to get somebody off, it's to show that Cohn did it. I got it from Cohn to show he got it from Cohn to show Cohn's guilty. And I said, well, that constitutes no problem. So I started researching this. But I find that what the courts have held is that there really is a corroboration requirement. It's not in the rules, but the rest of the government's case corroborates it. Because this hearsay statement alone would not be sufficient to get it to the jury. So the rest of the case corroborates it. Oh, and what about the fact that the statement might be a self-serving statement made in plea bargaining negotiations? Well, the court would say, well, those kind of statements have to be carefully scrutinized to make sure they're really against interest. So the court said, see, even though it's not in the rule, we do the same whether it's offered to inculpate or exculpate, so there's no constitutional problem. Which I don't think they really do, but that's how they finesse the constitutional problem of having a one-way only corroboration requirement. So, I lose on two issues in that case. A, it's not so far against his interest because it was self-serving to get himself off. B, it wasn't corroborated. Now, next issue is declaration against interest. And this tends to be, declarations get a lot of different interests, but it tends to come up more in declarations against penal interest, as in the case I just told you, the definition case. This is the following. I robbed the bank with John. Or if you like, John and I robbed the bank. Or more often, it was all John's idea, that's why I robbed the bank. Now, these are all declarations against my penal interest, correct? Assuming I'm not available, I rob the bank, federal crime, it's what, 20 years in jail, it's clearly, and then raising against penal interest. And we'll leave out that it's made in a setting in which, you know, there's no detriment to me. But remember I told you that this whole area is really an exercise in part in linguistic analysis? The divide the statement into the component part theory didn't work with the courts. When I was busily urging them to look at the part of the statement that was against penal interest and forget about the purpose of making the whole statement. But the notion of looking at parts all of a sudden now triumphs and is exactly the thing we have to do. Why? Well, I robbed the bank is a declaration against my penal interest, but John Ann is not against my penal interest. I robbed the bank against John Ann. No. Because I can take away the John Ann, and the statement is just as much against my penal interest as it would be if I added the John Ann. That is, John and I robbed the bank. Which leads to the argument that the identification of John as a participant is not a statement against my penal interest. The whole thing is against my penal interest. My purpose in making the statement is against my penal interest. But the identification of my associate in crime is not against my penal interest. Everyone understand the theory? Therefore, the tendency is to redact the John and just introduce the statement, I. And under a case called the Bruton case, that may not be even viable because to admit a statement as a declaration against penal interest against me, when the jury would hear it and might use it against my co-defendant, violates his constitutional rights. And we're not dealing with confrontation yet at this point. We're dealing with the fact that it isn't admissible against him because the statement was not a declaration against penal interest. Because the part of it that implicates him was not against my interest. And that now tends to be the prevailing doctrine. The identification of an associate is not a declaration against penal interest. Now, you might be asking, well, who cares? Because it's a co-conspirator statement, right? Well, wrong. Unless it's made during and in furtherance of the conspiracy, correct? And an awful lot of these statements about John and I robbed the bank are made to undercover people after the crime or made to the police after you're arrested. So they're not going to be co-conspirator statements and not admissible. So it's good that you thought that it might be a co-conspirator statement.
Why wouldn't you just look at the purpose of the statement? Because now when both kinds of statements come in, you look at the purpose to see whether it is really against the penal interest.
Well, and the answer to that question is because the lawyers who made the argument that the John part of the statement, I robbed the bank, is not against my penal interest, prevailed. And the courts agreed with that view that identifying the other person was a tag on because I'm just as liable if it's Tim and John and Mary and Harold and, you know, George W. Bush and it doesn't make any difference in terms of my criminal liability. Now, there are, however, and it's good you asked that, but there are, however, some circumstances in which the court have said that the John part may be against your penal interest. As in, John and I seem to have robbed the bank, but John was there, but he really had nothing to do with it. It was all my fault. May have sense when you're being sentenced for robbing the bank, and you said, John was there, but he really had nothing to do with it. Or, I tricked John into doing this, he didn't know. So, in some circumstances, very limited, the identification of an accomplice, or the release from liability of an accomplice may really be against your penal interest. Why? Because you're going to get a longer sentence. It was predominantly your fault. But otherwise, who you did a crime with isn't against your penal interest, doesn't count.
And at sentencing, what does that mean, the curry effect? Because you're
kind of
trying to get a lower sentence by admitting your
sentence. No, no. I am solely responsible. I get a higher sentence than if I said it was John's idea. So when I say John was involved only because of me, I'm making myself more responsible. It's my sentence, not his sentence. It's my sentence that I say this happened. And in that circumstance, I am creating the risk of a longer sentence by making myself the prime bad guy rather than the junior bad guy. And courts, by the way, very often do distinguish between the person who is the motivating force in the crime's occurrence and people who tag along, depending on the records and the scope of liability. But that clearly is a factor that makes me at risk for a higher sentence than I would otherwise get. Now, the declaration against penal interest scenario, in which the statement is made after arrest, along with the next topic we're going to consider, which is the prior recorded testimony, are the two areas in which the Confrontation Clause and the Davis case that I distributed, which really is the Crawford case, because that was the seminal and major Supreme Court case. These are the areas in which the court most often had to deal with the implication of the Confrontation Clause of the Constitution. However, the Confrontation Clause from the Constitution, just like some other clause of the Constitution, comes from the fact that in the late 17th century, a guy named Cromwell took over in England, executing the king. I think it was James II, I'm not quite sure what it was. And he ruled as a regent rather than the king. And because he was busily protecting the public against the horrors of the monarchy, he developed some law enforcement mechanisms which were loathed by the English public. And one of them, by the way, was that he forced people to give information about what they had done when a crime was being investigated. The Fifth Amendment comes out of that one. And he had people could be convicted based on sworn statements by witnesses, and that was a trial by affidavit. Confrontation Clause comes because of that one. And the Confrontation Clause basically says that criminal defendants, not civil, criminal defendants have a right to confront their accuser. And the Confrontation Clause, when one starts taking it seriously, and by the way, when I say starts taking it seriously, how many people take the crim pro? I'm not going to ask you a question. How many people have taken crim pro? In con law, did you do the incorporation? Incorporation in con law? That, you know, that the amendments to the Constitution become applicable to the states because they become part of the 14th Amendment? Anyhow, same thing. Everything was moving all sorts of nicely in the country, and then one day the Supreme Court decided, you know, this 14th Amendment has a little phrase, due process, in it. And we don't know what the hell that means, but I think it means almost all the rights in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution, and then it means the states have to follow all of those constitutional rights. Now, before the Supreme Court said that, no one really had to care very much about the Confrontation Clause, because, of course, very few cases are tried in federal court, many, many, many in state court, and the 14th Amendment, and the Due Process Clause, and the Confrontation Clause didn't apply to the states. Well, it got incorporated, and then, bingo, it did. And now, we constantly have these problems. And that is, the prosecution wants to offer into evidence statements that people made to the police after they were arrested as declarations against interest to show John is guilty, because I said things like, John and I robbed the bank. And the lawyer for John said, you can't do that. The accuser is Kessler, who's saying John and I robbed the bank. He's saying John robbed the bank, correct? And it's a hearsay statement, and Kessler isn't being called to testify. I'm just testifying. Declaring, witness. I can't be cross-examined. He can't cross-examine me. File his confrontation. Now, as I said, no one really cared before it applied to the states because it's a scenario that didn't happen very much. But now this happens all the time. And the Supreme Court, really starting in the 1960s, started in a series of cases to consider when evidence that was admitted as exceptions to the hearsay rule or as non-hearsay would violate the confrontation clause, because the defendant's claim, anytime such statements were offered, that is, anytime the declarant wasn't on the witness stand and the witness was, that it violated the confrontation clause because the person who was accusing was the declarant, and by definition, if it's hearsay, the declarant isn't testifying, the witness is. Go back to, you know, remember my first session about there's a declarant and a witness with a dual role. The declarant is never there. And they said, therefore, hearsay violates the confrontation clause. Now, of course, analytically in interpreting the Constitution, this is somewhat of a problem because hearsay existed before the confrontation clause. I mean, that is, they had this idea of hearsay in the 18th century in England, and so they sort of knew about hearsay, and since no one said a word about the confrontation clause changing the hearsay analyses, it's sort of hard to say that all hearsay was out now. So once they started taking it seriously, it was very difficult to figure out exactly in what circumstances hearsay did and in what circumstances didn't violate the confrontation clause. And the Supreme Court sort of sidled up to it backwards in the 60s by looking at it first as an attribute of the right to counsel. And that's why the hearsay exception we'll get to in a while, after I talk about confrontation, of course, probably, the hearsay exception we'll get to in a while tended to be the vehicle for most of these early cases, and that had to deal with a preliminary hearing, where somebody testified against at a preliminary hearing, wasn't available at trial, and the transcript was used instead of the person. By the way, the declarant is the witness at the hearing, the witness is the court reporter, and the witness at trial is the court reporter, so you put in the transcript of the court reporter. And the issue in the very first case was, well, the guy didn't have an attorney at the preliminary hearing. And if he didn't have an attorney, he never effectively could confront the witness against him. Because you need an attorney to effectively confront. That was in the 60s when the court was also seriously dealing with the right to counsel in terms of having counsel when you didn't have sufficient assets to hire an attorney. So this seemed to be an attribute of the right to counsel. And it simply says here, you know, turn to this hearsay exception, prior recorded testimony. If you didn't have counsel, you never really confront him. Next was the same kind of thing. But instead of not having counsel at the hearing, this time, the guy really wasn't unavailable. The trial was in Texas. The witness who had testified at the preliminary hearing was in Oklahoma. And if they wanted to get him, they could. And I always like this because in interstate compacts between the states, Texas and Oklahoma, they all had agreed on a writ of habeas corpus ad testificatum, which means they could send some Texas marshal to the jail and show him the piece of paper, and the Oklahoma jail would give the guy to the Texas marshals to transport to Texas to testify at trial and bring back. And they didn't bother to do that. And the Supreme Court said, well, you know, confrontation clause is violated. Well, wait, not by introducing the hearsay, but by introducing the hearsay when you don't have to. So, unavailability became a constitutional requisite. It became a matter of a constitutional right that the state established that the guy was really not available. In other words, it was okay that you didn't confront him because necessity became an exception to the right of confrontation. Third case, same thing. Except this time, And I told you, it's always the girlfriend. The girlfriend testified at the preliminary hearing. And when the government goes to subpoena for the trial, they can't find them. And it means the mother says she's moved to California. This was in Chicago. She's all from California. Oh. The prosecution doesn't go bother to try to find her in California, write her a letter, give her a telephone call, and they say, hey, she's unavailable. We went to look for her. She's not there anymore. And the Supreme Court said, no, you have to prove she's really not available, and we need a hearing to see whether the government tried hard enough. When they went, you know, did they try hard enough? The judge just accepted the notion of unavailable without having a hearing. So the Supreme Court remanded the case for a hearing to determine whether or not the government had made enough effort to determine whether or not the person was really unavailable. The lower court found that she was not available. But nonetheless, we have this whole doctrine. And the Supreme Court then began to say, no. Since we got this idea that you have to be really unavailable to fit in with this historic requirement of unavailability. Remember I told you 804 unavailability comes right in common law? What we really mean is that, you know, only the traditional hearsay exceptions should be confrontation exceptions. So if it's not well vested as a hearsay exception, if it's sort of a new thing that got created, maybe that shouldn't be a hearsay exception. And they began to discuss in the subsequent years whether or not it was a well vested or a not well vested, whether it was truly reliable or a little sneaky and not maybe reliable to determine whether confrontation caused the fire. And then along came Crawford, which is the case you have in Davis. And Crawford essentially completely reconceptualized the relationship between hearsay exceptions and the confrontation clause. And what the court did is it changed the dynamic and said, in my words, not theirs, but this is the substance, said, hearsay exceptions don't matter. Hearsay exceptions have nothing to do with the confrontation clause. Because the confrontation clause is designed to protect defendants against a particular evil that the government might do. And the particular evil is substituting affidavits prepared for use at trial for the testimony of the declarant who made the affidavit. It is this process of taking statements from people that everybody knows are going to be used to implicate somebody and then not calling into evidence the person who made those statements. They had nothing to do with whether the statement is reliable, nothing to do with whether it's a traditional hearsay exception, nothing to do with whether the guy is really unavailable or not. What it has to do with is the government doing this evil of carefully getting statements which, at the time they're made, people know are going to be used in court and then not calling the declarant. And therefore, what the court said is, the issue to decide to determine whether or not the defendant's constitutional rights have been violated is whether at the time the statement was made it was a testimonial statement. And then of course they went on not to define what a testimonial statement was. But it's a testimonial statement. But they did give some examples. Remember that good old preliminary hearing? Clearly a testimonial. Everybody knows it's testimony. Remember that declaration against interest when you're speaking to the cops after you've been arrested? Clearly everybody knows the cops are looking for information to get John. Testimonial. So, that sense allocution when you talk about how you committed the crime, clearly that's all testimonial. So, those are examples of what is testimonial. So, what's not testimonial? Well, right away, here's a bunch of things that we know for sure aren't testimony. Remember that co-conspirator statement made while the crime is going on? Well, even if you're busily making that statement to a cop who is busily recording it, that's not testimonial. Why? Because the person making the statement, the person talking, isn't aware of the fact that this is going to be used or might be used to implicate somebody. They think they're recruiting somebody to sell them guns at a cheap price. They think they're getting somebody to steal a getaway car. And therefore, their state of mind is not in any way affected by the fact that they know that this statement might be used to implicate somebody. And therefore, those kind of statements made as part of the commission of a crime, they are not testimony, even if they're made to a cop. Because, of course, in those circumstances, you wouldn't know if it's that it's a cop, or if you did know it's a cop, you think it's a dirty cop who's cooperating with you. So what we get is that what's going to be considered testimonial is now limited to statements that are made to a law enforcement person or a government person in a setting in which the declarant has reason to think the statement would eventually wind up being used in court. So we'll talk about Davis after the break. And then go back to how this relates to declaration against interest, and the next exception being prior recorded testimony. Oh, by the way, while you're there, if anybody wants to make $100 by being a witness for a day, it's $100 per day, on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday during the trial techniques program, if you're not taking the program, we need witnesses to be police officers and criminal defendants in a CLE course that we're running simultaneously.
So if we're not going to have this now,
are
Thank you.
I quickly mentioned the end that it's actually on the 7th and 8th, Wednesday and Thursday of January. If you're not taking trial technique course, you're not to Bahamas, you're not any place interesting, you can all earn some money on each day by being a witness. On the first day, you get prepared for your testimony. You're either a cop or a defendant or a witness to a crime who's a friend of the defendant. And these are all motions to suppress. There's a Fourth Amendment motion. There's a Fifth Amendment motion. There's a waiver. Various motions. Then on the next day, you testify at the hearing. Now, if you say, why did you do this? Well, because you make some money. But the other reason why you might want to do this is this course is being run for attorneys who work for New York City Legal Aid Society, and half of the teachers are going to be supervisors at New York Legal Aid Society. I've heard they hire students. So if you sort of are impressive, there might be people who remember you. So, yeah.
Will we be disadvantaged taking trial techniques without Crim Pro first?
No, this isn't trial techniques. No, no. Trial techniques has nothing to do with Crim Pro. You don't need it at all. This is a separate CLE course that the school is running for attorneys who work at the Legal Aid Society, and it's a 3-day course, and we're able to run it at the same time because often get more faculty than I really need. So some of the faculty who volunteer to come and teach you won't mind teaching somebody else once they hear all that. And if I don't have more than I need, then I don't want the CLE course.
There is a trial technique meeting tomorrow, right?
I'm right, 11 o'clock in room 308. But this isn't trial technique, it's completely different. You can't do this and do trial techniques. I'm just saying, if somebody wants to, I'll also tell my torts class, but why shouldn't you guys, if you're around?
So if you want to do it, sign up to be a witness, how do you do it?
You put your name here and your email address here, and do remember it's the one you actually look at, not the one that, I don't want people to have my real address because they bother me. Because then I send you something, you don't look at it, you don't look at that one all the time. I just, by the way, sent an email inviting an attorney who went to Hofstra. I've been trying to find out where she is. She probably graduated about 6 years ago. And I got a pad out. It might have been this one. And, tore off the top pages, and I think I can use it. And there was a piece of paper in there, which was the names and addresses of the 16 people in the seminar with their email address. So I figured, who gets rid of an email address? So it didn't come back, so maybe she'll show up. She was in ABA for 3 years. Now, back to hearsay. Confrontation clause. So, what Crawford tells us is that instead of looking at the reliability of the hearsay, the nature of the declarant, we look at the scenario. And the scenario is to be examined to determine whether it's testimonial. Now, that's what Crawford said. Davis was decided a year after Crawford. Davis deals with a particular hearsay exception we haven't gotten to, but I think it's more useful to talk about this confrontation issue at one time. And this is the scenario, this testimonial, the declaration against interest of the cops after you've been arrested, the prior recorded testimony, which we're going to get to next. This is exactly the scenario in which it clearly arises, and both are clearly testimonial in the same behavior. Now, the Davis case deals with a statement which has the aura of testimoniality, but also has an aura completely different. And that is the 911 call. Help, help, he's killing me. No? Help, help. He hit me, he's running down the street, I'm bleeding. Well, in terms of hearsay exceptions, we'll again eventually get to 803 exceptions. And when we want to call the 911 operator, instead of calling the declarant who's going, help, 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 you're killing me, we're introducing hearsay. So to introduce it, 911 instead of the declarant, you need a hearsay exception. Now, it's not going to be declaration against interest. It's certainly not going to be prior recorded testimony, help me, right? But there's a thing called an excited utterance, and there's another one called a present sense impression. In other words, the hearsay exceptions we're going to get to. So, for us to get to a confrontation issue, you have to get around the hearsay clause, and you have to get the statement in. So to deal with a Crawford issue, you have first a hearsay issue, and then if you get past hearsay, you have a confrontation issue. The hearsay issue is, does it fit in one of these various exceptions? The Crawford issue is, at the time the statement made, was it testimonial? And what they said in Davis is that this 911 statement really isn't one statement. No? We're back to yes, I know, it's all my fault, right? Does yes mean yes, I went through the red light? Or does yes mean yes, I understand, I'm as responsible? What the hell does it mean? So, what they're doing here is they're saying, look, 911, help, help, he's killing me. That's not testimonial because the purpose of speaking is to get assistance. Help, help, I got cut, I'm bleeding. That's not testimonial. Help, help, my husband just stabbed me. That's still not testimonial. Help, help, my husband stabbed me. He left and he said he's going to Harry's bar. I'm bleeding. Wait a minute. Help, help, he stabbed me. That's not confrontational. But he said he's going to Harry's bar. And the police officer says, and where is Harry's bar? Oh, that's on the corner of 7th and Elm. When did he say he was going to go? In other words, the statement that starts out as a statement which is not providing information that the declarant would think is information that is clearly used or to be used in a criminal prosecution can morph into a session in which the cop is interviewing a potential witness and getting information. What did he attack you with? Where did he get it? Does he still have that weapon with him? I mean, all this stuff is no longer stuff about help me, motivated by the desire and the need to get assistance. It now becomes giving information details which, if you could think for a moment, is likely to be used to go find the guy and arrest him. And essentially that's what Davis says, and you have to take a look at Davis to see how they sort of divide it up. But a statement can be made that gives lots and lots of incriminatory information to the cops, but when its purpose is to get assistance, it's not testimonial. As soon as the nature of the conversation changes, if it indeed starts out as a cry for assistance, then what's said after that is testimonial and can't be used without calling the declarant. And it doesn't matter if it fits in a traditional hearsay exception. It doesn't matter if it's not hearsay, non-hearsay. If the thing is testimonial, it's a separate evil having nothing to do with the reliability of the statement. It has to do with the impropriety of the government conduct in soliciting the information and then not calling the declarant. So that's how the confrontation clause has now been created, and we're pretty soon going to get to an exception called a business record. And the case that the Supreme Court is deciding this term, it was just argued 2 weeks ago, has to do with whether or not the scientific data in an autopsy, which is used to conclude that a person was murdered rather than die of natural causes, is something that an expert can testify about without calling the person who actually did the scientific studies. So can the pathologist who tells you what the cause of death was tell you in that testimony the blood work report without the blood work person showing up? And the claim, of course, was the person did the blood work solely and exclusively for the purpose of determining whether to prosecute. It's clearly testimonial. And the alternative is, well, it's ministerial. And we will see in a month or two or three or whatever how the Supreme Court decides that. But because they didn't define testimonial very much in advance, we find that there's going to be many years of dealing with what's testimonial and what's not testimonial. But it's an innovative new way of dealing with the idea of what interest the Constitution is protecting in this confrontation clause. And I personally would never have thought of it, but once it's been thought of, it seems to me pretty impressive as a realistic application of the initial problem that the Confrontation Clause was designed to resolve, and how that problem plays out in present police activities that should or should not be limited. So it seems to me it turns out to be a pretty good idea. How it will be applied, who knows. And by the way, the notion is that all of the stuff that we used to talk about the 25 years as being confrontation violations or not, out of the picture, we don't care anymore. So we don't care if he's really, really available, if he's not really, really available. What we do care is, for confrontation purposes, whether or not it was testimonial. And if it was, no matter if he was available or not available, it's still testimony. Now, that's declaration against penal interest. It's the constitutional imprimatur. And Crawford is really important, even though I just lectured on it for half an hour rather than going through cases and dealing with hypotheticals. That's something for now in the future you really have to know. You have to be able to recognize what could be a testimonial scenario. And by the way, don't forget the typical constitutional traps for the unwary. It's a civil case. Clear Crawford violation, up, down, backwards, except it's being offered in a civil case. No confrontation rights in a civil case, no Crawford violation. So that's the sort of law school equivalent of 2 times 3 equals 5. You know, it says, you know, you're careless, it looks right, but it isn't. And law professors like asking those questions. Oh, not me. Maybe. Now, next exception here, also under 804, is this thing called the prior recorded testimony. Now, the first thing about prior recorded testimony, we got a lot of priors around, right? I mean, we got prior inconsistent statements. We got past recollection recorded, which sort of sits close to prior. You got to keep these things different. They're different, and why are they different? They're different because they involve different scenarios. Different, if you will, snippets of the play where everybody's on stage and what are they doing? Well, they're doing different things when they create, for instance, a past recollection recorded. What they did was they wrote down some report of some sort or other involving activities that they were personally involved in or that they knew about, and now the scenario switches and we have this little courtroom scene where the person who wrote that report is saying, gee, I don't know what that happened, I don't remember anymore. Right? And that's a past recollection recorded scenario. You had the first scene, they're writing these reports. Prior inconsistent statements, the guy's sitting there on the witness stand and we're attacking his credibility, correct? Now, when we deal with prior recorded testimony, what we are is back in the wondrous world in your legal education of civ pro. And I know everybody loves civ pro. And do you remember T1 and T2? From CIPRO, trial 1, trial 2, jurisdiction 1, jurisdiction 2. Remember all that stuff? Well, we're now in the world of T1 and T2. And that is the first trial and the second trial. And what do I mean by that? Well, you can't have prior recorded testimony without having had testimony. Now, testimony is something that happens at trials, but I'm using T to include hearings, and indeed, I really have to be a little broad, depositions. But it's testimony. And if it's testimony, that means there has to have been direct cross-examination. Otherwise, it's not testimony. If not, prior recorded affidavit. Prior recorded affidavit doesn't do it. So that means virtually, not entirely, but almost everything that is used as past recollection recorded isn't going to count here because it's not testimony. Now, I have to admit, sometimes, and we did have a case I talked to you about, sometimes the prior recorded testimony and past recollection recorded could be a transcript. Possible. But that's very, very rare. Usually, the past recollection recorded is some kind of written statement it probably isn't even sworn to, and it doesn't matter. And now we're talking only about transcripts. Transcript means direct and cross, or as we can see, at least the opportunity to direct the cross. So that's the way to be able to identify this. No transcript, it can't be past recollection recorded. Transcript, it might be something else as well, but no transcript, no past recollection recorded. Now, in terms of hearsay exceptions and reliability and hearsay dangers, this one is almost a conundrum, an unsolvable logical puzzle. And what do I mean by that is, if hearsay dangers, if you remember, lie, mistake, are mitigated by indicia of reliability, oath and cross. If we have transcript, what do we have? Oath, cross. How can there be any hearsay dangers here? Oath, cross, oath, cross. Where's the hearsay dangers problem? Answer, there really isn't any hearsay dangers problem. So what do we have? We have here a policy statement that the prior statements of witnesses, and this exists even though the federal court even says the prior statements of witnesses when the witness is available aren't hearsay in the definition of hearsay, it really is. We don't want prior consistent statements being popped in here up, down, and backwards to buttress the testimony of witnesses. We don't want to put in, oh, and here's what he said at the deposition, and here's what he said at the preliminary hearing, and here's what he said at the first trial, and see, here he is today saying the same thing four times, three times now. See how he's consistent. We don't want these prior statements to be made. Now, why, even though there was oath and cross? Because if, and this is consistent with what I've been talking about in evidence, and I think it really is a fundamental policy in our Anglo-American system, we think the jury can do the job that probably they can't do very well, which is determine credibility, because they get to see the people sweating before them. They get to see the people hemming and hawing and choosing the words and looking the way they look when they speak. They see them. Now, we understand that there are circumstances in which you can't see him because the guy's dead. Or he's in the hospital in Pennsylvania with his heart problem. Or he's something else. And we understand we may have to make an exception when it's necessary, but day in and day out, the jury's role, which is so difficult to anybody to do, only is intellectually viable if they actually see the person testifying, which is what? Which is determining credibility. So we have to protect that, and that means that you can't let the party put in transcripts simply because they have it. So what? They're not going to be able to put in transcripts unless it's necessary. What about hearsay dangers? Well, forget about it. We prefer live testimony because that's the only way a jury can do its job. So, you can't get in this transcript unless it's necessary, which is defined as 804A, unavailable, right? So, it has to be unavailable, then it's necessary. Okay, now we'll make an exception. Not, of course, if it's testimonial, because that's a constitutional right, which would be violated, but we're going to make an exception here if necessary. No hearsay dangers, but jury dangers in not being able to assess credibility, but not being able to look at the person. And by the way, did anybody know how you actually read testimony into a record when you want to read testimony in? I mean, you could just say, Now I'm reading the testimony of John Smith, and this occurred at a preliminary hearing in 2006, and the following testimony: what's your name, John Smith, where do you live, blah, blah, blah. Question, answer, I just go question, answer, ridiculous. So they tend not to do it that way. What they tend to do is, I will ask the questions, and you will make believe you're the witness and give the answers. However, we're not allowed to ham it up. So it has to be rather flat. And that's the thing, you know, in other words, if you're not just reading in a few lines of transcript, if you're reading pages, it tends to be done that way. Well, there we are, this guy just saying yes, no, I think so, you know, flat. No credibility. It makes it a little more listenable than having you read both sides. But that's why we don't want to do it. That's why we want to have the witness there live, if possible. Yeah. This is the policy background. Easy to understand, agree or not agree, really easy stuff. Here's the more difficult stuff. Prior recorded testimony is always reliable because it's under oath. But the question becomes, is it fair to let the party who wants to introduce it against the other party? Is it fair to let it in? Well, now they're talking confrontation terms, but not confrontation constitutional right basis. And what I mean by this in terms of confrontation terms is, it really isn't fair to have this testimony introduced against me if I had nothing to do with this prior trial hearing or whatever at which the testimony was taken. And it's not fair to use it against me because the credibility issue that I would like to have explored on cross may not have been explored, but I was there. So, I don't want to attack this person's credibility for reasons 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 10, who knows? I'm concerned with whether or not this guy could see or not see. And the party against whose interest the testimony was being offered when the guy was there live didn't give a damn about whether he could see or not because his vision had nothing to do with the facts of that case. Now, the testimony that they need against me happened to be mentioned, but that's not really what he's talking about. And that's not fair, because even though there was testimony, even though there was cross, it wasn't the cross that would have been done to protect my interests. So it's not fair, even though there was cross. So, in 804, in this exception, what we wind up with is the following. We find out that we have the alternative indicia of reliability that doesn't focus on oath and cross, but rather focuses on whether or not the person against whom the testimony is being offered had his interest represented when the guy testified the first time. Which makes this something like collateral stuff. Something like collateral stuff. And what I mean by that, and I'll continue more on Thursday, what I mean by that is, obviously, if P1 is me, the red car driver, and the green car driver suing me, and there was a hung jury, we tried it again, and I don't like it because I think my lawyer did a lousy job, screw me. I mean, you know, my interests were being protected, it's exactly the same thing. But a lot of things can change between T1 and T2, not involving me. Maybe, by the way, the first case was the green car, I'm sorry, was the passenger in the green car against me, not the driver. Maybe the new case is the driver, the passenger in my car against me, and the first case was the driver of the other car. Maybe the present case is me suing the manufacturer of the car I was driving in.
And the witness that we're going to talk about is always the guy who was standing on the corner who said, the red cone is the red line. Is it fair for that transcript to be used, no matter who the defendant is, no matter who the plaintiff is? That's what we'll be covering. And if you're interested in making some money and being a witness, a cop or a defendant, or a friend of the defendant, who's very heavily impeachable, just let me know. But you have to be there on both days. Wednesday, Thursday. Have to be there both days because you get prepared to testify on Thursday and testify.
Two questions.
You have one
salary. Okay. I was asking my question. My question is, how do I know if my employer could actually fit in this frame to send me a letter?
Hey, how are you?
The answer is nobody is sending a letter.
Nobody is.
That's right. That's the answer.
Just don't send them a letter. So I know, just
well,
I met with them. I told them. I gave them all the materials.
They have very little interest in getting that letter out.
Yeah.
And you have no need for the letter until the first day of class. In fact, you really don't use the end of the drop period. So, my view of this is that they send the letter now in November. There's a fair chance it's going to get lost. What's against you? Who are I don't know how close they are, how familiar they are, how informal the kind of place is.
I don't know.
But unless it's a really formal place with great distance, I mean, it's sort of enough to ask them in January. They remind them they are in January. They're caught that they, well, that's a weekend. Six, that you do need that letter. If they haven't gotten it out yet, here it is. You may, in fact, have to wait until you show up, write it for them, have the secretary type it, and have it signed and hand delivered because they don't care. But that's maybe not.
It's more stressing me meeting mandatory because I work.
Do you know somebody who can tape it, take notes? We're handing out some material, but
yeah,
we're really, this is, I have a 34-page schedule, and every activity is assigned, but it's assigned by numbers and letters, and it's very peculiar, because if you used your name, it would be a book, you know, every name, where you are, who you're in. So explaining how the schedule works is important. Now,
okay,
if somebody can explain it to you, that's fine.
Okay, I'll be there.
And there is material that you're going to have to pick up afterwards because the publishers didn't send up some of the printed material. We're only handling out part of it.
Okay.
But, you know.
I can pick that up from you?
No, from Marcella Fernandez at 216.
Okay.
And the most important thing you have to know, by the way, is whether you're an A or a B. The A will represent Rivas Bovin in a matrimonial case, and the B's represent Hubbard. And it really doesn't matter, but for counseling and negotiations, you need information just for your side.
Right.
So because first you're going to take the deposition of their witness, I want to give you the facts of their witness. So you have to know if you're an A or B before you can pick up the material. So
okay.
Different packets for readers and Mikey's.
So someone can find that out for me?
Well, one of the things that's going to be distributed is a piece of paper on what everybody's name is.
Okay.
And the name is in a section, and you have a number and a letter.
Okay.
So you're going to be something like section 2A4. Well, if you're an A, you're a reader.
Okay.
And there'll be 2B4s and 1A4P, you know, something on it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
But you only need, well, you need extras of the schedule. But you really don't need.
Tell me about it. So I'm just
like,
I just got up and I got into the clinic, so I have to drop a lot of classes.
Yeah.
I was wondering if I should keep my advanced trial technique over applied evidence. And
who teaches advanced trial technique?
It's a name I didn't recognize.
Give me the name. What's the course? What's the course description?
It's just like, have to take like the trial technique and the prereqs. And I guess they do like like an over a broad overview of like trial
technique. It's not Ben Rabinowitz?
No, it's not Rabinowitz. That I know because he's
are you a senior?
No, who else?
Take Rabinowitz on the man. Take a Rabinowitz next
level.
Oh, he's terrific.
And I'm also on the evidence report team, so I think the applied evidence might help me with that, with the team.
Well, you talked to Barron.
Yeah.
Okay. I see the applied evidence. Did you take review? No. Yeah, I'll take the applied evidence.
Take the applied evidence.
Yeah, and then take Rabinowitz.
For
it's a no-brainer. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. of the course, which is good because we are pretty much almost done, of course. Just a quick reminder, we will not be having class next Tuesday, which is one of the reasons why. Is that a hint by here? Okay, sorry about that. So we'll not be having class next Tuesday, so we will be focusing on this doctrine, the substantive due process doctrine, for this part, today, Thursday, and in our final class on Tuesday, Monday, December 1st. Got that? When they change the days on me, it gets so confusing. All right, so our last class is at 4 o'clock on Monday, December 1st. Sure. Okay. Alright, so that's it for us. This is the last topic of the course. In a lot of ways, it's really more of an introduction to what you'll be doing next semester. But for traditional reasons, we've always done at least a little bit of this discussion of substantive process and other rights in the first semester to sort of lead into the second semester, which is primarily concerned with doctrines like this one. Okay, so today is really the beginning of the conversation, a conversation which will go on for the rest of the semester and frankly go on for the rest of next semester as well. So it's important to sort of lay the groundwork. Alright, now some of you may be wondering, just as a quick side note, to what extent are you responsible for this material on this exam? And obviously it will not be the primary focus of this exam, because this exam will be primarily focused on what we spent all of our time doing this semester, which is questions of constitutional structure. But to the extent we've discussed it in class, it's fair game for the exam, and we should be sort of aware of it or prepared to discuss it on the exam. Obviously, it could only be a somewhat minor part of the exam, but it could be something that's worth keeping in mind. Okay. So today what we're going to do is we have a little unfinished business with respect to takings. In particular, some discussion of the way the court analyzes the public use requirement. And then we'll sort of begin our conversation about rights. In particular, about the way that the Constitution thinks about rights. Okay? And in particular, how it got to the point where the substantive due process doctrine became, in a lot of ways, the most important source of individual rights under the Constitution. But before we get to that, we'll have some unfinished business with respect to the takings doctrine, and in particular, the public use requirement of the takings doctrine. Alright, so what we've been trying to do last talk was begin the shifting, away from our conversation about constitutional structure and toward what we're doing now, this conversation about constitutional rights. Okay? It's not a clean-cut distinction, but generally speaking, structure refers to the powers held by the U.S. government, whatever powers they have. They have the power to do this, or they don't have the power to do this. Okay? Their power is related by some other branch's power. Okay. So we'll have a commerce power. Constrained. Limited, perhaps. I have executive power. These are all about powers. That's, generally speaking, what we talk about constitutional structure. We talk about powers. Powers of the government. Now, obviously, rights are a very different focus. What is the focus with respect to rights? Rights is largely focused on the question of, well, actually, this is sort of our conversation today. What are rights, and how are they different from powers? Right? How are rights different from powers and constitutional structure? Well, what we want to sort of talk about today, I think, keep this in your mind as you go through both the takings discussion and constitutional substantive due process doctrines. What is it about rights and that makes them different? What is it significant about it that makes it different? And the way we wanted to look at that a little bit was through this conversation about takings, the power that you're sort of familiar with. In takings doctrine, the power at stake here is the power of the government to essentially use eminent domain, right, to take your property. They have the power of eminent domain. That is a power. That is a power. So it's not really a rights question at all. Now, just one way to think about it. In what way is the question of takings also a question of rights? Perhaps we can
So we can say, well, takings doctrine is just about whether or not the government has the power to take your land. Okay? You might just say that's the question of constitutional structure. It's like saying whether the government has the power to regulate this activity under the Commerce Clause. Okay? How is that different from... Is it how might we rephrase this in a way to think of it as a rights problem? And how does the court rephrase it to think of it not just as a question of power, but as a question of rights? Yes.
Last class we talked a little bit about you can also look at it as the right to compensation. Since you don't have the power to refuse when the government takes your property, the Constitution provides for a right to compensation, and it also further limits the power with the public use.
So there's a power, right? And the power is limited by a right. What's the right? Yes.
Right to have property.
Now that's interesting. So I have the why the right to have property that pre-exists the power of eminent domain.
Right.
Power of eminent domain allows me to take your property. So you're right, I have the right to have property. I sort of, I almost think I need that to take it, but it's not property, right? And once they take it, right, what rights do I have? I have the right to compensation. Right? Which is sort of one way to think about it. The right to just compensation. So the government has a power, but it's limited by the right. Right? I have a... Here we go. Okay. I have a right to just compensation. So that's a right, not a power. Power is held by the government. Power is hard to take. Okay. The right is the right to compensation. And notice the right is held by the individual, the power is held by the government. And so, obviously, what we'll be doing in takings law is kind of both, right? Takings is both the question of power, right? Who has the power? What's the scope of the power? And then there's a question of rights, right? I have a right to just compensation. The individual has a right they can assert against the government and say, you have the power, but I have a right that I can assert to either override or limit the exercise of your power. So in takings doctrine, right, the government has the power. Okay? There's no question it has the power. The federal government probably has the power. Certainly the state governments have the power. They have the power to take. Okay? And you have a very limited right. The right is for just compensation. Now, one question is, what about the question of public use? Ms. Johnson, you suggested, is that a question of a right, or is it a question of power?
I don't really know if the public use requirement is a...
Right, is it a right to have my property taken only for public use?
Yeah, it's not really a right, it's more of a different kind of check on the power.
Ms.
Still
up?
Is there a limit on the government's power
So you might conceive it as a limit on the power. It's not a right. Why isn't it a right, do you think?
Well, it is your right to have that limit on the government's power, I guess.
Right. Well, you see how it blends together, right? My distinction is a little bit flimsy, right? My right sort of sounds like a power, yes?
I guess maybe the government has the power to take it from public use, but there's the right that's implicit in that is the...
So I have the right to property and not have it taken except for public use or not have it taken for private use.
Right. But that being the right to the power is still public use.
Okay, so this allows you to, I mean, power is really just, the public use requirement is really just a limitation on the power, but you might describe it as a right, like here, a right to have it only taken for public use, or a right to not have it taken for certain purposes. Now, what's the significance of this distinction? Well, it's not a whole lot of significance. It's just a different way of analyzing the problem, right? From the one perspective, you say, I have a right, individual holds some ability, some rights, okay, that the government is bound to respect and guarantee. And the second way, the power is a question. Well, remember, the Constitution, the government can only do what it's authorized to do. Right? So if it exceeds its authority under the Constitution, it's powerless. Right? It no longer has that power. So it's not a question of a right held by an individual, it's just a question of whether the Constitution has given that power to the government. Generally speaking, up until this point this semester, the only question we've asked is, has the Constitution, or some other source, but usually the Constitution, given a power to the government, to a particular branch of government, and is the exercise of that power consistent with what the Constitution gave to that branch? Okay, and even, I think the public use probably fits mostly within that, although it's a little bit of a mixed question. Now we're also going to start asking questions of, even if the government has the power, right, are they nonetheless unable to exercise it because there is some right that they cannot violate? That's sort of the new question that we need to start asking. Right? And you might think of public use as a little bit like that too, right? They have the power to take your land, but you have the right to make sure they take it only for public use, I suppose. One way you can sort of transform it into a rights conversation. And it's a different analysis because now you're focusing not on whether the government has the power exactly, but you're focusing more on what is the nature of the right held by the individual. And that's why it's important to keep this in mind as we move forward, because we're now going to start talking about mostly about rights. Which doesn't mean we're going to stop talking about government, but we're going to talk about rights a little bit more. Now, interestingly, with respect to the public use doctrine, which we didn't really finish our discussion of on Thursday, how does the court decide whether the public use doctrine is satisfied? Right. So what is the test? What is the test they establish? Right. What is the test for whether or not public use, the public use requirement, is satisfied? Remember, I did say. How do the majority sort of decide? How should you decide now, going forward, whether or not the public use test is satisfied? Yes?
Because the first legislature will give a definition of the
public sue test, public sue. All right, so that's sue. I was thinking sue, but public use, yes. So, go ahead. They give deference to?
To the judgments of the legislature, as long as they have a factual basis.
Okay, now that's an interesting test, right? So, in other words, how do we decide whether or not the government can do what it's going to do? How can we decide whether the government has fulfilled its constitutional obligations? How do we decide? We look to see whether the government has thought it's doing what it believes what it's doing is consistent with its constitutional obligations. In other words, we say, well, how do we know whether they've satisfied public use? Well, do they think that they've established it consistent with public use? If they have, well, sounds good to us, right? Sounds like there's a good chance that they have, right? That's, in some sense, that's a lot of what the test is, right? So it's, you know, the test is we give broad latitude to the legislature. The concurrent suggests the way we think about this is that if there is a rational basis for them to think that there is public use, then it's public use. That's, I think, an interesting approach. But now, what's the sort of, Mr. Lau, let me sort of bring you into the conversation. Why would the court adopt this test? What's the reasoning behind adopting this test, do you think? Right. Why would the court adopt a test which says we want to know if the legislature has fulfilled this requirement, right? So you take it for public use. We look to see whether the legislature believes it's taking it for public use. Why do we do that? Why would this test make sense? Give the court more power?
No, I mean.
But the court is saying that, look, if we don't really know what public use is, if the legislature thinks it's public use, and that seems reasonable to us, then it's public use. Right? Well, is there some reason why a court would adopt such a generous approach, yes.
To limit,
why would a court want to limit lawsuits?
Because that means if someone's really, really bringing a lawsuit to test the government, you better have a really good reason
for
what
you're trying to fight. Okay, it does make it harder to win a lawsuit. Okay. Although, the courts aren't all, I mean, I know sometimes the things that courts really don't like lawsuits, but they actually, sometimes they like some lawsuits. Like this one they might like, right? But it would limit, they wanted to create a tougher rule, right? But why? Yes. Yeah, that's a good possibility, right? So, and if it's a question of, right, then the legislature is a better position to know what is a public use, right? What is a public use than a court would? At least there's one possible rationale. The court itself, in the decision, pretty much said, well, all the other cases say it. That we do this, so we're going to continue to do this. But what is the question is, why do they do this? And I think one, there's a possibility they want to avoid litigation, right? They're not really sure what public use is, so they leave that to legislature. Legislature's better position to determine whether it's public use. Now, Ms. Kane, though, do you think that's a good idea, though, to leave it to the legislature to determine? What's the danger with that? Is there any danger if you leave that to the legislature? Yes?
If they want to win, they can make the rule according to what they think it should be, and then take land.
Well, they could take your land, right? If they want to take it for public use, which they sort of have to, they get to decide, for the most part, whether it is public use. Right? Why is that a problem? What's the danger there? They could decide for themselves, and therefore, so what? Why are we upset about that? Or should we be upset about that? What's the consequence of this? This test, what's the practical consequence? Yes?
It gives them unchecked power to speak.
It gives them unchecked power, although, you know, unchecked power compared to whom?
Well, the court can't now say that this court is what helps them.
Right, so the legislature is free to act without the court's oversight. Well, the court's not going to provide oversight. And then the other concern here, yes?
It's like
rule by the mob. And we're worried by rule by the mob. Other people call it democracy, right? We're worried about rule by the mob because... Yes, and that one person's rights are threatened. Right. The concern is with the person's rights. Right. Democracy is a good rationale for giving deference to the legislature. And the only countervailing argument, or the most persuasive countervailing argument, is that, but we need to stop them from doing this because they might abuse the rights of some individual. That's usually the rationale. The rationale is, well, we need to get tough with the legislature. We need to make sure that we're keeping them in check because otherwise they're going to infringe on someone's rights. That's usually the concern here. I mean, and so is this really about rights or is it about power? Well, in a way, every power question is in a lot of ways about rights, right? We're trying to see whether the government's power can be somehow constrained in order to protect people's rights. And here it's quite stark, right? The person's property is at stake. Their right to own that property is at stake here, to some degree. Their, well, at least their right to have it not taken, is to some degree affected by how broadly we interpret, or how generously we interpret the public use requirement. And I think that reflects, that sort of concern is reflected in the dissent. Right. The dissent was not impressed by the argument that, well, you know, this is they're more democratic, we've always done it this way. There's an interesting argument in the dissent here, which I thought was Justice O'Connor's dissent. A wonderful philosopher, actually, I believe. One of the philosophers, I think what if we treated all rights this way? Actually, this is not Justice O'Connor's, it's actually Justice Thomas's dissent. What if we treated all rights this way? All sort of rights in a way that's sort of very generous to the legislature's judgment. If you look on page 330, this is Thomas's dissent. Focus on his dissent, because it kind of puts it into relief here. He makes an argument we should not defer to the legislature on the question of public use. We should not defer to the legislature on the question of public use. Why not? Yes.
Is an originalist.
Right. Justice Thomas, yes, is originalist, right? Okay. And what is, in this case, what does originalism tell him?
It tells him that the original meaning of public use is that government can take property only if it actually gives the public legal right to use the property.
Okay, so it's only for the government's use or open to the public. It cannot be retransferred to private individuals. All right. Now, one interesting point he makes is that comparing it to other rights, right? What if we treated other rights this way? Right. So some of you are familiar with the Fourth Amendment, even though you haven't studied it. We've all heard of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is that neo amendment that requires them to do things like not search you without a warrant. Right. We won't study it here because there's a whole course called Criminal Procedure, which is basically, as far as I can tell, just about the Fourth Amendment. The entire course, every single day, a new Fourth Amendment case. So it's a really, I don't want to make it sound like a bad course. It's actually a really good course. But there's so much in the Fourth Amendment that, it's not worth trying to even talk about in this class. Now, the Fourth Amendment does have a very famous requirement. You cannot be subject to an unreasonable search. Right. Okay. Now, Justice Thomas makes the point that what if we treated unreasonable, or in this case, reasonable, okay, in the same way we treated public use in the property context? Right. If we treated the reasonable search requirement in the Fourth Amendment the way we treat the public use requirement here in the Takings Clause, what would be the result here? Why would that be concerned? What would be the problem with that?
Well, it lends itself to massive abuses by
the legislature. But legislature say, well, that's a reasonable search, right? Showing up at your house, putting a little camera through your window, and zooming in on everything in there. We're searching through all your computer files. We define that to be reasonable. And the court says, well, we defer. That's reasonable to us, right? If it's reasonable to you, it's reasonable to us, right? What's his point, larger point there? If the legislature gets to determine...
Well, I think maybe his larger point is that part of the court's function is keeping the legislator in check.
In order to do what?
In order to comply with the Constitution.
And the consequence you're looking for, right, comply with the Constitution, and the benefit we hope is protect rights. Right. A lot of the core of this is saying, look, the more deference you give legislature, the less likely you're going to protect individual rights. And we don't give deference to legislature. His real point, we don't give the deference to legislature on other rights. Why should we give them deference on this right? This is a right, not just a power. And why should we give deference to them? Yes.
Well, it seems that some weight is given to the development plan that the town had.
Yes.
The lawmakers had. So isn't that kind of, so that proved or in their eyes it was reasonable.
Uh-huh.
The court looked at it and the court said it was reasonable they had a development plan. Isn't that the same thing with a warrant? It's just a warrant. You just have to compile facts that you think give a reasonable belief to serve.
Yeah, but here's the difference, though. Okay, what is who gets to define what is reasonable? Does the court define it, or does the legislature get to define it? If the legislature provides facts to sort of satisfy the reasonable standard, okay? But he's saying that here, how do they define public use?
Okay, I don't understand. What I see is in this case, the court looks at the development plan.
Yes,
and they are the ones stating that the development plan had enough facts in it to be reasonable.
So the standard is not reasonable. The standard is public use, right here. Right.
So, yeah.
But no, what I'm saying is, but how do they know? They said it looks like it's good enough for us. But why do they think it's okay? Do they say we've examined it carefully, and we decide that in fact there is a public use here? It's a different argument they make. It's not exactly we've determined that taking land for Pfizer and for economic development is in fact a public use. Do they say that exactly? They phrase it a little differently. Yes.
No, they seem more focused on the fact that the government of New London has made this comprehensive plan, and that they say that the plan is designed to improve public welfare, therefore they seem to think they're operating in the public use, therefore they fulfill the public use requirement. So it's less the court saying, look, here's the test for public use, and they fulfilled it, and more they say it's public use, that seems reasonable, therefore
it's okay. It's a slightly different analysis, and it's important that we clarify this, because in one way they're saying that is a public use, but here they're saying it's plausible to us that that is a public use, and if the legislature thinks so, we'll defer to what they think is a public use. Whereas in a warrant requirement, and again, I don't want to get into this because, frankly, the Fourth Amendment is a disaster, but, yeah, a warrant is generally speaking the idea is, here's a warrant. Is it reasonable? Right? Is it reasonable? Was there a reasonability for issuing the warrant? And is it a reasonable search? And that's not defined by the legislature. That's defined by the court. The court gets to define what is reasonable. Here, the court is giving some portion of this power to define what is a public use to the legislature. Yes, you have a comment, Mr. Chair?
Yes. In defense of the deficit of the legislature,
yes.
I don't think that the Supreme Court is necessarily in a position to decide what is best for public use. For instance, in the material on substantive due process, the court has repeatedly struck down progressive legislation that would help people in the name of protecting rights, when in fact, they actually increase the misery of working people in this country.
I have strong views on this point, don't you? You need to find someone who. I think that's a very plausible view, right? Although there are people who would say that they were upholding individual rights. Now, you raise the point that the crucial point is the court in a good position to determine, right, when the government has violated the rights? And you're suggesting they've screwed up. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that later. Today, actually. Okay. But the argument in favor, we've already talked about the argument in favor of them doing it, right? Protecting individual rights. The argument against is that they'll inhibit the democratic will, what the Democrat majority wants to do. And so this argument then becomes about democracy versus individual rights. In the public use context, the court has gone with who? Have they gone with individual, or they went with the democracy? Fletcher?
It's gone with this conception of individual rights.
Well, no, but what the dissent did. But the majority went mostly with democracy.
Oh, the majority?
Yeah, the majority said, hey, we're going with democracy here. I mean, we'll have some limited review. But effectively, if the public wants this economic development, we will not stop them. Right? We will not stop them from doing so. But their judgment is better than our judgment. Now the question for us is, to what extent would the court always adopt that approach with other kinds of individual rights? Yes?
I think that the fact that there's a lot of possible lobbying going on in cases where there might be cases for development.
Yeah.
I think that the court shouldn't take that into consideration when they decide they're going the democratic way, because it's a lot of these cases are being pushed by particular individual groups with their own purposes and interests.
Uh-huh.
It's not really the public that wants it, it's just these private agencies are pushing for this type of thing.
Private agency that pushes the government.
Right.
Because that's true. That I think the basis argument was down to it's not really democracy, it's just government captured by evil special interests or bad special interests, right? All right, that's true. That would call for them never. I mean, we don't really trust the government then, do
but
we?
But I think it's particularly interesting in this case because they're giving it to a private agency. And a lot of the times, the person that they won't back, the bear movement from private to private. But so many times, a private agency is involved in some way that I think it's disingenuous to say that, it's not really going to a private agency.
Okay, so maybe they should have been honest and said, we don't even care if it does go to a private agency. Right? That's fine. Whatever they want, that's good for us. We're not worried about this. Right? Yes, did you?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think Justice Thomas made an interesting comment about the other situations, the rights that make up, but the key difference is that those are criminal contexts. individual rights. This is a private property right. So I don't think the court would say we need to give deference to, you know, defining what's an unreasonable search of people. But at the same time,
so different rights get different standards.
Right.
Some rights are more important than other rights. This is not as important as other rights. But that's one way to think of it. But I think the problem though is the same, right? Whenever we have a right, the question is often how much deference should we give to the government and what they claim they're really doing. Yeah.
Sort of along those same lines, I think in it's much more difficult in a case like this where you're talking about taking somebody's property to draw any kind of bright line rule or create any kind of standards that's going to work in every market in such a large country. Whereas when you're talking about, let's say, a warrant or, you know, what you have to show in order to make it reasonable to search that person, you can set certain standards and say we've got to meet these five things, and as long as we have those, everything's fine.
Okay, so there's a kind of practical argument, right? It's not practical to have a uniform public use requirement, but it is more practical to have a uniform sort of warrant requirement. That's an interesting idea. I'm not sure I buy that completely, but that's a nice idea. And it goes along with the idea that each right is different, right? Some rights have different consequences. Some rights are easier for the courts to enforce than other ones. Right? This is one that is not easy for the courts to enforce, I think. At least they're suggesting that. Yeah. Now, what I want to sort of do take away from this, other than the fact that you should obviously know the public use test, right? So if there's a fact pattern which says, oh yeah, the government took the land, gave it to them all. There should be some flags, and so, you know, don't just say, well, whatever. All right. But other than that, take away this basic framework, right? When there's a right in question, constitutional right, there's often going to be a question of to what extent how does the court determine, right, assess the government's action vis-a-vis the right? Do they give deference to the government? Should they be suspicious of the government? How much review should they give to the government's action when the government, because the government will always say, well, we need to infringe on this right for some reason. So even though there's some right, it's about the individual, often these rights cases will turn on the government's actions and whether the government's actions was appropriate given a particular standard of review. Right? Because as we'll talk about, rights here are about rights against interference by the government. They're not rights against interference by, you know, Pfizer or some other company. The rights that the courts are concerned with, for the most part, are rights that are rights asserted against the government in protection, to sort of protect you from what the government might do to you. So that's sort of the focus. And so therefore, what the government is doing, the judgment as to what the reason the government is, sort of why the government is doing something, is always part of the conversation when we talk about rights. We're always going to talk about governments and what they're doing, why they're doing it, when we're talking about individual rights. It's kind of our line, I guess. Okay. All right, so that's sort of the base. That's sort of the framework that we're going to see again and again as we go forward the rest of the semester and next semester. Alright, Kelo, by the way, just as a footnote, Kelo was a very sort of famous case, not famous, but it was the type of case that got people really excited. Blogs got really outraged, people had protests. And I believe that Justice Souter, who signed the Kelo opinion, his house in New Hampshire, they thought about the local village decided they might condemn it and take it, just give them some money for that. They didn't. You know, his farm, he's got a farm or something. So people were very angry. But actually, there's a remedy, and the court actually had said, well, if you're really upset about this public use thing, what could you do to sort of protect the rights more? Yes?
Petition the legislature.
To do what?
To make it a more stringent standard.
Right, because when the state goes and takes your land, they're bound by state law to have stricter requirements for what would constitute public use. And in fact, after Kelo, about 20 states instantaneously adopted legislation that did make it much harder to, in fact, do what they did in Kelo. Right? So the state can, in fact, give you more rights than the Constitution requires. Right? So that's an interesting possibility as well, is that, well, maybe the rights can be protected by just going to legislation and saying, give me those rights. And the Constitution doesn't have to sort of get involved there. All right, so that's a footnote to Kelo. Now let's move on shift gears and sort of time remaining in this first hour, talk a little bit more generally about rights under the Constitution, and then about the way that the Constitution has thought about, or people have thought about how the Constitution could more broadly protect individual rights beyond just the ones that are like this one that's specified directly in the Constitution. Okay, so let's go to step back and take a breather. Think about rights in general. Okay. What are rights? Okay. This is a question that, for those of you who've taken political philosophy, can sort of regurgitate your John Locke for me. So just spit it out, please. John Locke. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Oh, you do remember. Okay. I was joking, but when we say rights, what are we thinking about, Ms. Johnson?
John Locke was particularly interested in the right to property, but he talked about, he was more of a natural law.
So that's the question, where they come from, but what does it mean to have a right? I have a right to do something. I have a right to...
It's inherent.
Inherent. Okay, some... And what do you mean by inherent?
I mean, it's different than a privilege. A right isn't given to you. You inherently have it as a human being.
Okay.
Whereas a privilege is something that, say, the government gives to you, but they have the power to take it away under certain conditions.
Okay, so there's a right and a privilege. There's also a duty. Now, you guys know all about duties. Right. So the famous course for duties is Torres course, all about duties. Now, what's the difference between a right and a duty? I know that you guys are thinking, oh, no, not Torres again. So what is the difference between rights, a right and a duty? Sorry?
A right is optional and a duty is something you are obligated to.
Right, a duty is an obligation, right? It's like a duty to rescue, right? It turns out there's no duty to rescue, but there might be a duty to rescue in Torres, right? A duty, I gotta do this, I have a duty to these people, I have a duty, etc. Right? A right is, optional is kind of, I have the ability to say, but I don't have to do it. It's a freedom, perhaps, to have this ability to do something, but I don't have to exercise it. And so a right is often sort of framed as some sort of, it gives an individual some sort of choice, right? Some ability to make decisions within a certain sphere. Now, we're going to come to what is various emanations of rights, okay? But the interesting question for us from a legal perspective is, where do rights come from? Right, now, Ms. Johnson, I'm curious, you said they're inherent in being sort of a person. Right, you suggest, at least, or maybe you're paraphrasing Locke.
Yeah.
So that suggests that it's a natural law theory. Why? So where do rights come from, then?
Well, under the natural law theory, which is what I was saying earlier, rights are inherent, and they're taken, like, from either from moral or religious values, and also from a type of logical reasoning where philosophers would reason out, okay, here's the way society should work, and here's the way the rights that we have, whereas positive law is based more on here's what states do, and here's the rights they give their people, therefore those are the rights.
All right, let's start with this one first, but I like the contrast. So natural law, as I suggest, comes from, I just say the G word. God. God is probably, John Locke certainly thought this, right? But we don't think of it today because it's not quite as trendy. But God is the obvious source of everything, right? And would include things like rights, right? So among other things, so it might be God, or pick your deity. That was the source, right? It created the world, created the rights. Okay. Therefore, actually, what's interesting, the crucial thing about natural law theory, the rights are inherent. When I was born, I had all these rights, right? Because God created me and everyone else and gave me the rights. It's one theory. Or just I emerge into the world, nature. It's natural law that I have these rights. The difference between natural law, and as Johnson's getting this, the crucial difference is, in natural law, does the government have to give you the rights? To give the rights if there's no government? Ms. Johnson.
Yes.
Right, the rights exist whether or not there's a government, whether or not the government recognizes those rights. I have those rights. It's natural. It's sort of inherent. It can be taken away. It's not dependent on some constitution, some legislature. It's not dependent on that. It's natural. It comes from nature, or God, or something. Well, not supernatural, but not from a governmental institution. Okay. They're not. That's what positive law is. Positive law is a theory. Well, where do the rights come from? Well, the government, people got together, created a government, and they decided to give you these rights. Okay. This is kind of a crude sort of division, but roughly speaking, this is sort of a way that people think about it, right? There are rights that sort of are in the state of nature, and then there are rights that the government has recognized or given to you. Now, the people who founded the Constitution were mostly in this crowd. For the most part, they were, even if they weren't all believers in God, they generally grew up in a natural law tradition. Okay. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they thought that constitutional rights were natural law, but there's some reason to think that some of them believed that the source was natural law or God or state of nature. Okay. So that leads to the question then, when we come to the Constitution and we think about rights that are protected under the Constitution, should we think about rights differently than we think about powers? Powers, we know, must be given, generally speaking, by the Constitution, must be enumerated, ideally, spelled out in the text. But if you believe that rights are roughly emerging from natural law, you might think that rights don't need to be enumerated in the same way that powers are. Okay. If you believe that rights exist, pre-existed the creation of the Constitution, then those rights don't need to be in the Constitution. They already exist. Right? Already have the right. Okay. And so one way to think about this is the Constitution was not, in fact, drafted with the Bill of Rights. Right? The Constitution was ratified with just the Constitution. And there are very few rights in it. It's all about powers. So does that mean the people who drafted the Constitution didn't believe people had individual rights? So that's one problem we need to think about. To what extent do we need to look for a textual basis for the right in the Constitution, just like we've generally looked for a textual basis for a power in the Constitution? Or should we look to some other source, natural law, or some other source as a source of rights? Okay. Well, that's why the reading of Powder versus Bull comes in. So this is the object of, but it's kind of interesting. So this is from Justice Chase. And let me sort of bring this conversation with, Ms. Grinspan? Yeah. All right, so let's just go and read this, and then we'll talk about this later.
In that support of slavery, the right not follow law, contrary to the great first principle of the Constitution, and also consider the right to watch the body of one's great power.
All right, so this is a sort of semi-dicta in opinion, a very early Supreme Court opinion called Calvin versus Bull. This reflects a natural law approach. In what way? I'm sorry? Well, not so much you can't get it out of the Constitution, but what do we measure legislative acts against? Society. The great first principles of the social compact. What is that, you think? Yeah, what theory is that? Well, you know, whenever the legislature passes something, we have to measure against these great natural or first principles, right, that were out there, right? So you can't just say, well, the legislature passed a law, that's the law, right? Whenever they pass a law, it must pass, at least according to Justice Chase, must be consistent with those great first principles. Otherwise, it's not law. It's not a law. It's just an act, right? So he's taking a really hardcore review, right? Even though, remember, they just created this Constitution with all these checks and balances, right? So they created a law under this Constitution. He's still not sure it's a law. Because he says, well, we still have to make sure it's consistent with those great first principles of the social compact. which it's not alone clear what he's referring to, but probably rights that he believed existed or pre-existed the Constitution. Okay. So there's Justice Chase in the same decision. There's Justice Iredell on this concern.
A court cannot pronounce an act of the legislature void merely because it is a matter of contrary to the principle of natural
law. Okay. So a court cannot pronounce an act of the legislature void merely because in their judgment it is contrary to the principles of natural justice. Now, this is a classic positivist approach. Right? And why? Now, how, this is kind of a weird approach, too. If it's against natural justice, why can't the court pronounce it void in this context?
I guess
they do
that two separate
systems. Okay, that's nice. What do you mean, separate systems?
We have those systems that are supposed to be natural, and that believe that actually, I guess, they should.
So they should coincide with what's in the what the court should be doing. I mean, remember, what he's saying is that the court says, "Oh, this law it violates natural justice, but we're powerless to do anything about it. Can't declare a void just because we think it's contrary to the principles of natural justice. Why not? Why can't you do that?" Yes.
Well, I mean, if you take natural justice for the law, so when the social contract was formed, people gave up their some of the natural rights, like in the state of nature. You would have the right of preservation when you come into a social contract, a form of government to protect that right for you.
Okay.
And it's only the state technically not allowed to kill in society because you gave that right of preservation, right of protection to the government.
Okay, well, that one. Okay, all right. I'm following you there. But how does that apply here, though? So then, isn't the principle? So is your principle natural? Someone hits you in the face, you hit them back, right? But you're saying that they gave up that right in the social contract, etc. But is that really what's at stake here, though? Because here they're saying that. Well, this guy is saying, well, natural justice. The court should step in and say, if it violates natural justice, we should not enforce the law. And here they're saying, if it violates natural justice, we should go ahead and enforce the law anyways, right? That's sort of interesting. Well, not exactly, but something along those lines, yes.
I think maybe one of the problems is that natural justice isn't written down anywhere, so that's scared off of the merely study in their judgment contrary to the principle of natural justice. And that gives a lot of authority to the courts to decide what is and isn't natural justice, and maybe too much power to the courts.
So it's a problem because the courts have too much power versus the legislature. Because we don't know what natural justice is. We don't agree what natural justice is. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going to say basically what she said, but when going back to what we learned about taking the oath to uphold the Constitution, you're not taking the oath to uphold any other laws, so you can only really judge something on what is in the Constitution or in the legislation, not necessarily
what's outside of it. Okay, I like this. Let's bring back the oath, right? I didn't swear to uphold natural justice. I swore to uphold the Constitution, whether or not it's consistent with natural justice. Hopefully it is. Hopefully. But even if it isn't, right? That's not, I think the argument is that's not my job. Right? My job is just enforce the Constitution. Yes.
Of course, there's tension between the idea that natural justice, the idea that your morality should be influencing your decision. And if you uphold the law, that you see, obviously, if there's a law that says, if there's some authorization that the president gave that says, all right, I'm authorizing the troops to go out and kill citizens, innocent citizens, would a judge be a moral person if he upheld it? No, of course not. And then on the other hand, you're saying, well, I'm just a judge, and if I act on my morality, I could be going against the Democratic will.
Uh-huh. Right, now, I agree that is a tension. That's a rather extreme example, right? And that's a dilemma, right? You see, even at the very beginning, right? Justice Chase, right? He's natural justice. Justice Iredell, I don't think so, right? No, right? It's not our job. So, which is to suggest they didn't agree even when they started out this project. And that's why this is a great little case to start at least thinking about it, because that, frankly, is called. Every single fight over constitutional rights is this one, basically. One time I think, but wait, the right is so important, it's inherent, it's valuable, right? We need to enforce it, and the other side says, no, it's not our job. Someone else's job. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that generally speaking today, we don't say the natural justice. today, we do look to some source in the Constitution. In general, Iredell's view has largely won out, in that judges do generally, like Mr. Liana suggests, say, well, my oath is to the Constitution, and not necessarily just to natural justice. But like with everything, there's a way out of this dilemma, right? Because even in the Constitution, the rights that are enumerated in the Constitution can be drawn upon to support many of the principles of natural justice that Justice Chase was interested in. And so what we sort of are going to focus on then is we're going to end up focusing mostly on enumerated rights, rights that are enumerated in the Constitution. Okay. But then as we go through, though, and these are some various sources of them, the enumerated rights are often interpreted against the background assumption that there were unenumerated rights. There were rights that preexisted the Constitution that aren't specifically written into the Constitution. So even though we're going to end up spending a lot of time talking, well, Article 1 provides this right, or Amendment 14 provides this right, the background of all these rights is this idea from the very beginning of the Constitution founded that there are some rights out there that exist, that pre-exist the creation of a government that all people might have. Right? And many people believe that. Many people who create a Constitution believe that. And that has, I think, affected the way the constitutional rights have largely been developed. Okay. So you'll see that there's not a slavish attention to text when we talk about constitutional rights, because a lot of people think the rights should be interpreted against the background of this guy, right? Natural justice. Okay. All right, let's take a break. Okay, we'll come back and we'll dive into one attempt to elucidate those rights, privileges, and immunities clause.
Thank you. much more successful. And whenever we've been to the
guaranteed by nature, by God, etc., that there's a strong tradition of believing there are rights that are not enumerated, like written down and clearly explicitly, can still be a right, that right preexisted any man-made laws that might exist. This tradition is important to keep in mind as we move forward, because many of the actual textual rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution, some of them are really specific. Right. But many of them are relatively broad and might be understood to stand for a lot of these natural rights or natural law rights that many people were aware of at the time they created the Constitution. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this. Let's take a look at Just a quick tour of our Constitution. Sources of rights.
Okay.
Generally speaking, if you're looking for rights in the Constitution, you generally find them. The most important rights, individual rights, are in Article 1, Section 10, in the original Constitution, and then obviously in the amendments, Amendments 1 through 10, or really 1 through 9, but arguably 1 through 10, are all generally understood to guarantee a variety of individual rights. Okay. Next semester, I'll go through some of them in more detail. We'll also explain why we'll ignore almost all of them and focus only on the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. But there are all a bunch of other rights that are kind of interesting there. Anyone here is really clever, they can tell me what exactly the Third Amendment protects. It's one of my favorites. Trivia question? Third one. You don't keep that one ready to pull out and impress people. Third one. That's my favorite candidate for the most obscure amendment of the Constitution. The Third Amendment's got to be high up there. Yes, well, we'll get to what the Third Amendment is. But I guarantee that no one in America who studied constitutional has ever studied the Third Amendment possibly. Maybe it's time for a revival of the Third Amendment. Alright, so the Amendments 1 through 10, obviously a rich source of individual rights. And then, as I suggested last week, Amendments 13 through 15 are in many ways the most important amendments to the Constitution with respect to individual rights. If you look at the rest of the amendments, they're kind of boring and tedious. People get the right to vote. And they're expanding the right to vote in this part. And that's important stuff, but it's not as sort of interesting from a legal standpoint because there aren't as many interpretive questions, right? 18-year-olds have the right to vote. Okay. There's not much more to say, right? Okay, they have the right to vote. That's fine, right? Women have the right to vote. Okay, right? We're done here. There's nothing legally sort of interpretive there. There's a lot of interesting social questions, but not... These are the most interesting for legal interpretive purposes, Amendments 13 through 15, and especially Amendment 14. Amendment 14 is by far the most important amendment arguably in the Constitution, period. Certainly is arguably the most powerful amendment with respect to protecting individual rights. The 14th Amendment is where, to some greater degree, 90% of the action is. And the other 10% of the action in individual rights is probably in Amendment 1. They occupy, putting aside all the criminal law amendments, they occupy enormous amount of our jurisprudence. Amendment 1 and Amendment 14. Actually, Amendment 14 be a close battle with Amendment 1, they're big amendments. Amendment 14 is one that we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about this semester and then next semester as well. So these are all enumerated rights, right? What do I mean by enumerated rights? They're rights that are written in the Constitution, right? They're not rights that are drawn from some source outside the text of the Constitution, right? So the theory of these rights is that these are rights that the Constitution guarantees through explicit textual statements. And so the method is not that different from the method for powers, which is we look to see, is there a right? Well, we look to the text of the Constitution, try to find the right, and then look to that text to try to determine the scope of the right. So in some ways that might seem like a very simple method, but as we'll see, it can be rather complicated. Now, Amendment 14. Why do I think it's so important? Well, in what way does Amendment 14 differ? Article 1, Section 10, and Amendments 1 through 10. What's one of the most important ways it's different from the Bill of Rights and from Article 1, Section 10? Yeah?
Most of the rights in the Bill of Rights are incorporated
to the Amendment 14. Okay, now before we get to incorporation, generally speaking, Amendments 1 through 10 which I know you've memorized. Amendments 1 through 10 apply to which branch, which part of the government? They restrain which government? The state or federal governments? Federal, and only the federal government. Okay. Amendment 14, actually Amendment 13 was the first one. Amendments 13, but Amendment 14 and Amendment 15 were the very first constitutional amendments that constrained the states. Okay. They're the very first constitutional amendments. Now, there are constitutional provisions that constrain the states. But these are the first constitutional amendments that guarantee individual rights in a way that would restrain the state governments, that would constrain the state governments from doing something. That was applied to the states. This is a revolution. In the original idea of the Constitution, it was all about restraining the federal government, and the states were pretty much free to do whatever they wanted. And the concern was trying to restrain the federal government. The Bill of Rights was a Bill of Rights to protect you, not from the state of New York, but from the federal government. The state of New York could do whatever they wanted, pretty much. A few limitations here and there. And so what makes Amendment 14 so revolutionary is that it's the first amendment that explicitly guarantees individual rights against the states. Now, just a little background in history here, we can talk a little bit about, just to give you two paragraphs. When was Amendment 14 enacted? Ms. Gunther, when was Amendment 14 enacted? I mean, not the exact date, but the general time period?
Right after
the Civil War. And that suggests that what was the major concern for Amendment 14? If it's in the background of the Civil War. Why equality? I'm sorry, can you speak up a little? Oh. Sorry, I'm going to kill myself here. Yes. Speak up a little. I was so drawn in by the soft cooking. Yes. That's okay. You've got to learn to shout like me. I'm a shouting, right? I'm a shout doctor.
The case you mentioned that 14th Amendment is to piggyback on the 13th Amendment. And
basically extend the alright, I'm talking the abstract. Maybe we should just flip open the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment. Let's pull it out. 13th Amendment, it's actually one of the most important underused amendments. Okay. 13th Amendment. Okay. Article 13 is very famous. It's pretty clear what it's going to do, right? Article 13. Ms. Grunstein, what is Article 13? Amendment 13 do? Right. It abolishes slavery, right? And for obvious reasons, that was the primary concern of the first Congress after the Civil War. Right. Oddly enough, it's kind of hard to express that today, but even at the end of the Civil War, slavery was still legal everywhere except where the U.S. government had U.S. military had occupied the territory. So it was still legal back home in Maryland and other states that were not rebellious. Yes.
Yeah, but the 13th Amendment also allowed slavery to continue as punishment for a crime. This was used to the blacks were arrested under the black codes, and they continued being slaves. The convict lease system continued to the 1930s.
Right, let's sort of put that one aside for a sec, because that whether that was slavery was debated, but it sort of said, but the original form of slavery, right, the one that they were fighting, that was not the cause, but certainly one of the important factors in the Civil War, right, the classic system of slavery was abolished. That was the point of the 13th Amendment. Alright, now, I think the 13th Amendment was relatively successful in getting rid of most slavery. I can feel pretty safe about making that claim, but we can have that argument. In fact, we should have that argument. Yeah, 13th Amendment didn't do anything. Yeah, copy that. Right, 13th Amendment was important that they had to do it as an amendment. Believe it or not, Congress did not feel it had the authority to abolish slavery under Article 1, Section 8, and that's not surprising, right? under Article 1, Section 8, what power could they draw upon to ban slavery? Nope. Commerce Clause, right? No, no one was buying that argument in 1865. The only way slavery had been banned was by executive order through President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, but that was only during the war, right? So Amendment 13 was necessary to make sure that we could ban slavery. All right, that actually was not that hard. By the end of the war, everyone was, all right, we're gonna do this. However imperfectly. Now, Amendment 14, as Ms. Grunspan suggested, sort of came along after Amendment 13 and ended up being jurisprudentially much more significant. Amendment 14, as you suggest, Ms. Grunspan, is intended to guarantee, you suggest, equality, perhaps? Or, and what's the concern with Amendment 14? That we've already abolished slavery. Why do we need Amendment 14?
Are you asking in terms of the case or something?
Just in general.
I guess that was one of the questions we see that applied to.
Yeah, but remember, we haven't gotten rid of slavery, we still have the Bill of Rights, right? So what does Amendment 14 do that we got rid of slavery? We're done here, right?
Well, it references the immunities and privileges of citizens of the United States as well as of the state itself.
Yes. So we need to give them these privileges and immunities. Why? Well, what were they afraid of that would happen after they freed all the slaves, especially in the South? Yes. I'm sorry.
It refers to what Mr. Leschak was talking about, the black folks, that even though they were given the rights and freedom and equality under the 13th Amendment, they needed the 14th Amendment to somewhat enforce it. Because, I mean, with the black folks, they still weren't able to, you know, certain states still had restrictions on what blacks could do anyway. So it was like they had freedom, but no real freedom.
Okay, right. So, yeah, so I should move a little bit. Dismissive, but of Ms. Leschak's point. But the point was, but I think there was certainly concern about, and they were very concerned about, after the end of slavery, we would have the oppression of the now freed slaves who didn't have any other rights, right? So they're no longer slaves, but they have all sorts of, they don't have any other rights, apparently. The 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment were intended to guarantee some extra protections for them. But the crucial thing is, who do they think is going to be oppressing them? Who do the drafters of these amendments think is the oppressor? Yeah. The states. Every other amendment had assumed the oppressor was the federal government. Right? The aim was to try to prevent the federal government from oppressing the people. That's the obsessive concern of the entire Constitution plus Article 1, plus the first 10 amendments. Sorry. We need to protect against the federal government. What made these amendments different from our perspective is now they're really worried about the states. They're really concerned the states are going to start oppressing people, particularly the newly freed slaves, but pretty much everyone. Right? And so the 13th and 14th and 15th amendments were intended to really revolutionize the internal sort of activities within the states. Right? And the 14th amendment was to guarantee civil rights. At least many people believe, to guarantee civil rights for especially the freed blacks within the states, especially the recently rebellious states, but actually for all the states, that we need now, the Constitution now moves from regulating the federal government to regulating the states. We need to constrain the states, and that's what makes them different. All the other amendments are obsessively focused with Congress, federal government. And you notice that until this semester, every time this semester we talk about the government, too much federal government power. Now, for the first time, we're going to start talking about the state government. So what the state governments might do that would be oppressive, etc. So the 14th Amendment was revolutionary in this respect. It was intended to guarantee the civil rights of individuals against the state governments. Whereas Amendments 1 through 10 already guaranteed the civil rights, or at least a bunch of rights, of individuals against the federal government. So that's a great sort of shift in thinking that the 14th Amendment represents. Okay. That's, and, you know, it's not to be understated how important the 14th Amendment was. sure, the Constitution was created after a war, but these three amendments of the Civil War, many people call the Second Constitution, right? They really did create a whole different system of government. And it was a very bloody war that sort of made these amendments possible.
Right.
Without the Civil War, these amendments don't pass. Right? Unless you conquer, half your country and subjugate them, or you defeat them in a war, they're not going to vote for these amendments, right? So these amendments are, a lot of people call them sort of the Second Constitution. Like they recreated the Constitution in some very fundamental ways, and certainly for our purposes, they turn our attention now from the federal government and what the federal government's doing and shifting it to the states, what the states are doing, vis-a-vis individual people. Okay. Alright, so that's Amendment 14, and that's why we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Amendment 14, because Amendment 14 was perhaps the most, the broadest in scope. Okay. Amendment 13 was abolishing slavery, however imperfectly. Okay? I recognize that tune. Okay. At least it's not like an annoying song, it's just the annoying beep. Okay. And Amendment 15 is about voting, which is obviously a very important right. But Amendment 14 is the broadest one. Right? So it's about, we'll talk about some general guarantees of what they were thinking of at the time were what they believed were civil rights. Okay, so let's see how the key phrases in Amendment 14 were. Okay, this is the section 1 of Amendment 14. Maybe the rest of it is not as exciting. So this is, you don't have to sort of, it's kind of long, it's a lot to read. There are three parts to it. Okay. We can sort of focus on, let's go through each sentence by sentence, and each one has their own role and an important sort of position in thinking about rights. Okay. First, the first section. Nice. I got excited here. Lost my speeding card. Let's see. This one. Ms. Purcell? Alright, so let's talk about... Oh, you just got here. Okay. Well, I hope you're okay. Oh, okay. Alright, well then... That's a pretty good excuse. I hope that no one else has that excuse because you play a car accident out there. No, it's okay. It's a car accident that seems like a pretty good, I can't really say much about that. Alright, so let me pick up someone else. Let's see. Running out of names here. Yes, so we have Ms. Left of Karis.
Left of Right. I got two cards.
Okay, all right, I'm less upset to you. So, all right. The first sentence here, just read it for us and then tell me what the purpose is.
All persons born and naturalized in the United States, subject and jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state where they reside.
Okay, now what's the purpose of this sentence? Facebook gives you some clue to it, but certainly these Slaughterhouse cases have some discussion of it. What's the purpose of this sentence? Didn't we already know that all persons born and naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States?
Yeah.
Why do we need another amendment to tell us that all persons are born?
This is a way of applying this amendment to everybody.
There's a big group that was missing prior to this amendment. Who were they? They were, the slave. The former slaves, right? Once they stopped being slaves, they had a weird status, right? Because it was clear that it was prior to, when they were slaves, they were not citizens, okay? That was actually a prior decision of the court called Dred Scott, right? They're not citizens, right? So, this amendment and the first sentence was actually specifically intended to make sure that, just in case you're wondering, they're citizens now. Okay. So all persons born and naturalized in the United States are citizens. And just in case you thought that the former slaves, now they're free and they're still not citizens, you're wrong. They are citizens. Okay. And it seems kind of pointless to do this, but they really needed to do this, because otherwise the legal status of the former slaves would be very unclear. Right. This way, and there are two guarantees here. They're citizens of the United States, and they're citizens of what? A state where they live. Okay. Now that's important for a couple of reasons, right? Because they're citizens, now why do we need to make them citizens? Why is it important that we make sure that the former slaves are not clearly going to be citizens? What's the consequence of being a citizen? The constitutional, and it does apply, and they can assert constitutional rights. Right. And the one that actually they were really interested in was the right to vote, which they spent Amendment 15 on. In general, the idea was that we need to make all those people citizens. Now, of course, it's phrased very broadly. So anyone, right, who's born, in the state or naturalized is going to become a citizen of the state and the state where they reside. So it obviously applies beyond just the former slaves. But certainly at the time, the main focus was we need to make the former slave citizens. And that's actually most of what they're focused on in the first sentence. Okay, second sentence.
No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or duties of citizens of the United States.
Okay, now this sentence, or at least this clause. Now that we've made the former slave citizens, now what does this sentence do?
Grant some protection from the state government as well.
Does it? Right, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall do what?
Take away their rights.
What rights, though?
Grant them the Constitution.
Okay. This is the ambiguous part, right? No, they shall not abridge, not rights, but
privileges
and immunities, right? Whatever those things are. Whatever privileges and immunities citizens of the United States have, no state shall abridge them. Okay. Now, interesting, as we talk about slaughterhouse cases, we're not really sure what those privileges and immunities are. Okay. But on first reading, now, I think you have the right instinct here. What do you think privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States refers to?
To their rights.
To their rights. What kind of rights do you think?
Natural rights.
Right, natural rights is probably one possible source. Unenumerated rights. Another way to think about whatever rights that anyone else has. Right. Whatever rights that were guaranteed by the Constitution, right, may be covered by privileges and immunities. Although the term here is a little odd, it doesn't say right, it says privileges and immunities, which is a little bit different. Right? But in general, the idea is that you make the former slave citizens, and now you protect them against the states. Right? They have the rights, the privileges and immunities of any citizen in the United States. And so I think you might be able to read it and say, well, generally they're supposed to put the former slaves on equal status with any other citizens of the United States, vis-a-vis the states. Okay. Now, this clause here is going to be subjected to some really complicated interpretations. We're going to come back to that. But now the last clause, and this is a clause that we'll spend pretty much the next semester talking about. Go ahead.
Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, property without due process of the law, or deny any person within a jurisdiction the protection of the law.
Okay, now this one seems... what's the purpose of this last clause here? And how is it different from sentence 2?
I don't think it's very different.
You don't think so? Any sort of textual clues here that sort of suggests anything to you?
Due process of the law.
Due process of the law is a crucial phrase there. Okay. That is from privileges and immunity?
It must be different. The law wouldn't be in there.
Must be different. Okay. Due process of law is a phrase that goes back, many, as the court case would suggest, goes back to hundreds of years in England. Suggests unclear term what it means exactly. We talked about this already, right? From our perspective, due process literally means process, right? So you can't take away my property unless you give me process, right? And this phrase here is drawn from the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. we're now applying the Fifth Amendment language to the states as opposed to just the federal government. So the Due Process Clause is might just mean you've got to give me some process here, but it might mean something more. And we'll see that it turns out that this Due Process Clause means much, much more. Right? You might say from first reading that the Privileges and Immunities Clause is by far the most important one that protects rights, whereas this one is just about process. You know, you got to give me some process before you take away my life. Right? Make sure you give me some nice process before you kill me. Right? Whereas this one says you can't abridge the privileges and immunities. As it turns out, as we'll see, this clause, the Due Process Clause, becomes the vehicle by which most of the rights come in, even though it seems like this is the one that should have been the vehicle for rights to come in. The natural rights, unenumerated rights, whatever rights you might be thinking of. Okay. So now, and then there's this last clause here, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. This is also, now this is completely new. There's nothing in the Constitution like this clause. Okay. Prior to this. This is a big one as well. This is completely new. But it seems pretty obvious. Equal protection suggests what?
There's another protection towards...
How is it different from, say, due process, do you think? Equal protection.
That you can't make laws that would affect one group.
Differently from another group. You've got to be equal. Got to treat groups fairly. That's going to be a big part of the law here. This is completely new. Equal protection. That's going to be a big sort of conversation. So the story for the rest of the time in this section is just to establish there is some desire to bring in, to find a vehicle in the Constitution, especially after the Civil War, to protect a variety of individual rights that people weren't really sure were being protected properly by the states. Okay. And so the 14th Amendment is clearly the vehicle by which a lot of rights are going to be developed, right? Because it's a very broad language. The interesting thing is, why do they use this part? Well, why don't they use the Privileges and Immunities Clause? Why do they end up using this clause? That's the story of what we want to accomplish today, of why it is that, in the end of the day, we're going to ignore, pretty much for the rest of this year, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and focus obsessively on this clause here. These two clauses. And that's sort of what we want to sort of get through the rest of the day. Okay. So, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Like, after today, literally, it will come back only once, and it will be, we'll forget about it again. Right? So, it's really fascinating how this ends up becoming a historical artifact. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. All right, so let's go through the court's discussion of the slaughterhouse cases and try to explain how they interpret this phrase and why they interpret it in a way that ends up becoming, it ended up making this clause rather toothless. Okay, the slaughterhouse cases. I'm sorry, I mangled your last name. Or, it's the left Roberts, if I agree. Right. So, what were the slaughterhouse cases about? I guarantee you guys know the slaughterhouses.
The state of Louisiana passed a statute that gave the monopoly to certain slaughterhouses, and the other slaughterhouses that were trying to dispute it challenged the statute.
Yeah, so it basically said the law of the state said if you want to operate a slaughterhouse, you must operate here under our license, and no one else is allowed to operate. And so a bunch of butchers got knocked out of this stuff. Okay, so they challenge. Why do they challenge it? Or how do they, under what sort of claim? What's their claim?
That it infringes their rights to own and operate their property.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, they're destroying their livelihood, right? They had a business, they're operating their business, and just like, yeah, was it the state of Louisiana just took away their business? Okay. Now they claim, and then crucially for us, they claim which clause of the Constitution is the source of their claim, and which clause of the court? The Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. Right. So, if you just phrase it here, no state shall make and enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. in order for this to work, they obviously have to qualify. So they have to be citizens of the United States. They are. Okay. The question really is, are their privileges and immunities actually being violated here? What does the court say?
The court says that the privileges, they said it only affects the rights that were given to them upon the amendment was adopted.
Okay. So what do you mean by that? So they don't have the right to operate their business?
More or less.
The court has a very complicated reading here of the clause here. They say, look, this on its face it says, state shall not abridge privileges and immunities, right? Okay. Well, couldn't you argue very plausibly that the right to operate a business, they're abridging my privileges and immunities, right? Why does the court say that this clause ultimately doesn't apply here? Yes.
The court says it's important that they said citizens of the United States as opposed to including citizens of the states, the individual states, like they did in the clause preceding it.
Uh-huh.
And that, therefore, the privileges and immunities that are conferred in this clause are only those that the United States can give, so that things like the right to travel freely, something like that, but that not the right that individual states can give, which would be like the right to have a business.
Okay, so one way to think about this is that the only privileges and immunities that are protected here are privileges and immunities that citizens of the United States have, okay, and not citizens of a state. Now, it's kind of weird to think about it. What's the difference? Well, interestingly enough, which is the better source of rights, the state governments or the states or the federal? Like, which is a larger, richer source of rights, do you think? Why?
Probably because so much of the Constitution is devoted to protecting the states and giving power to the states, that it ends up being the states who get to give the individual rights, and they're not really, it's not the federal government as much.
Okay, so the states are the source of most law, maybe the states are the source of most rights, I suppose, as well. And that citizens of the United States doesn't seem like a very rich source of rights. That's one possible understanding, yes?
They say that the citizens of the United States and the citizens of an individual state, that was only meant to limit action of the federal government, of which you are citizenship under the federal.
Well, actually, it can't be just the federal government, though, right? Because this clause here explicitly constrains who?
Yeah, I know. It makes sense.
It explicitly constrains the states, not the federal government. The federal government's already constrained by Article 4 of the Constitution, right? So here, this is one of the most curious readings of any clause of the Constitution ever adopted by a court, but it's a little, there's more impacting to do, right? So it's not so much that it only applies to the federal government, right? What do they ultimately decide this clause does? Like, I think you're right, you're drawing it as federal, not state, but it's not just, you're trying to protect you from the states. Crucial thing, which states does this clause protect you from? So let's go. Yeah, does it protect you from your own state? It protects you from some state, right? You would think so. And yet, yes? Yes. Ah, see, you don't need casebook, you don't need notes, you don't need anything. The puzzle of this case, they said, what this means is that if you go to some other state, you're protected from that state. But you're not protected from your own state, what your own state does to you. Why? Okay, now, the harder question, why? Well, that's the crucial language that's missing. Right? If we go back to this. This clause says, all persons shall be citizens of the state and the state wherein they reside. this clause says, no state shall abridge privileges of citizens of the United States. So the argument is it should say of citizens of the United States and citizens of the state and where they reside. So that's the argument, right? The argument is that, look, this is intended only to protect you from when you go to foreign states. So if you're in Louisiana and you go to Texas and they start abridging your privileges, all right, now you have a claim. But if you're from Louisiana and Louisiana comes after you, you have no claim. Yes?
My problem with that was the fact that I thought exclusively the United States would thus be all-inclusive, including the people that are in your own state. So I don't understand how they can turn around and say, oh, only foreign.
It is kind of odd, except that they rely heavily on this phrase here, right? And of the state wherein they reside. Why is that important?
Because they need to add it again.
Because why didn't they just say, if that was true, they could have just said citizens of the United States here as well, I guess. Like, why do they say that all persons are subject, are citizens of the United States and of the state where they reside? Why didn't they should have said it again here if they intended for it to limit the states. Okay, now this is, it's almost inconceivable that a court today would adopt this interpretation. Okay. But there's something animating the court here that we almost don't have the ability to understand after 150 years, 100 years. What was the court really afraid of here? If they adopted the interpretation that the butchers or the slaughterhouse guys wanted, right, what were they really concerned with? What would have become, what would have happened if they said, this means that you can challenge the state's actions against their own citizens? Yes?
I mean, they were afraid of making the federal government too powerful.
Yes, but in particular the federal courts, right? Because what would happen then?
Well, then the courts could judge anything that the states did.
Within their own territory, to their own people.
Even maybe state law.
Yeah, and that was something that was alien to the people in 1866. Today, by the way, that's pretty much all you do. If you're in federal courts, you spend all day long. Yeah, state law. You know, but in those days, that was like, whoa, we can't do that. Right? The states were really like foreign, each was a little foreign country, right? Each one was like their own little country, and you didn't mess with their sovereignty. If you went to Texas, you didn't tell Texans, hey buddy, stop beating up that Texan. Yeah, if I want to beat up a Texan, let me beat him up, right? You know, now if you beat up someone from New York, that's different, right? That's a foreigner. You even say language today, even today, like if you, you know, they're foreigners, anyone outside the state, and they're citizens of the state, right? And that was, I think, the thinking there, right? There was a real concern that this would be really intrusive. This would lead to a deeply intrusive role for the federal courts in sort of reviewing the conduct of the states, the day-to-day conduct of the states. So how does this, this is a little bit of a, sort of after the fact rationale for their reading. But what's the concern reflected in this clause here? It's a left. Sure. I'm just going to not pronounce your last name, it's a point of view. Yes.
You,
yes. Just go through this clause, but this is the language you can read it for us, and then we'll talk about it.
Such instruction would not include this court's perpetual censure upon all legislation of the states on the civil rights of their own citizens with authority to nullify such.
Right, so the key phrase here is a perpetual censor. Right, if we read the Privileges and Immunities Clause to permit us to protect citizens from their own states, right, protect New Yorkers against New York State, protect Louisianans against Louisiana, then the federal courts, as we were just suggesting, right, are going to sit around being a perpetual censor, right? Every time a state did something, someone would go to federal court and say, no, I can't do that. Why is state depressing me? Come help me. All right. And they said, we don't want to do this. That's not right. That can't possibly be what they wanted us to do. That would be too much. That's so different from the way our government works. That can't possibly be right. Now, do they have an alternative explanation for what the purpose of that clause is, then? Or, and more broadly, the purpose of the amendment. According to the majority, what is the purpose of the 14th Amendment? How should it be understood in general? What's their main purpose of the 14th Amendment?
I guess to grant citizenship to
people. Right. Who's the main sort of focus of this amendment? Why was this amendment passed? It was about the former slaves, right? It was about the former slaves. It was about African Americans. It was not really about, arguably, and this is something the court was saying, and it's not really about anyone else. Is that right? Is that right, you think? It was just about former slaves? Is that their argument? It's just about the former slaves, sir. Okay, and so therefore, why is this therefore what the slaughterhouse owners want? Why is this outside their purview, though? Well, not so much it doesn't apply to them, but does giving the butchers the right to challenge the slaughterhouse, does that advance the cause of protecting the freed slaves, protecting blacks in the South? Not obviously, right? Right, not obviously. And so one thing they were concerned with is to try to keep the 14th Amendment from being used too expansively by individuals and groups that were not intended to be protected by the 14th Amendment. And in a lot of ways they read it rather narrowly to say, hey, this is about trying to protect the former slaves in the South. Now, that's probably true. Is that fair to say that's the entire purpose of the 14th Amendment? Does that seem like a plausible understanding of the 14th Amendment? It's just about the former slaves? Actually, I'm opening this one up. Yes?
Well, I think it's interesting that the 13th and the 15th Amendments are so specific to the rights they grant, like you said, whereas the 14th Amendment is much broader. And while you could see from the historical context that one of the reasons for it was to help the now freed slaves, it never specifically uses the language of slaves or freed African Americans or any of that sort. So I think you could argue that if it was only supposed to apply to them, then it would have been written more narrowly as well.
Sure, I mean, I think that's one argument, yes. Yes, it does, right? The 15th Amendment is really narrow and specifically targeted toward protecting the voting rights of Negroes, right? Right, Negroes is the first term of the part. So a long time since I've used the word Negro. All right, so dangerous ground. Actually, if I'm looking at it, it doesn't quite use the word Amendment 15. It doesn't quite use that word, does it? What if they really focused on Amendment 15? That was, Amendment 15 is about the right to vote, but do they limit it to blacks? Now, it's really about race in general, right? You can't use race or previous condition of servitude, right? That's where they're really getting at the group they want to get at, right? Who are we talking about here? Not even just, any sort of, generally, anyone of different races, and in particular, the group that was in servitude. That's a very kind of roundabout way of saying, oh yeah, the slaves, right? The people who were enslaved, right? Those people, okay, get the rights. Those people are going to get some voting rights and some voting rights protections. So they want to protect those people. But in some ways, that's more specific because it's just the right to vote, right? And it is focused on the former slaves, right, to some greater degree. Yes?
I also announced that the match is extended to black women.
The right of citizens to vote, child. Article 15, Amendment 15 does not extend it to men? That's what? Well, that's how it's interpreted, yeah, but it doesn't actually say women or men, right? So that's a fair point, right? So black men could vote in after Amendment 15, but not black women, right? Which was not all that sort of surprising, given that white women couldn't vote either, right? So that was a variety of limitations on that clause. But the larger story here is that Amendment 14 contains the broadest language. Okay? Amendment 13 is about slavery, Amendment 15 is about voting, Amendment 15 is actually particularly targeted toward the voting rights of the former slaves, And then this clause here, which is the most important clause or section of Amendment 14, is just about all persons, okay? And about no state shall abridge privileges and immunities. It's not the broadest language in some respects, right? And it was thought that it was largely intended to guarantee a very broad set of rights of individuals against the states. So a lot of people do think the 14th Amendment was the most ambitious in some ways of all the amendments to the Constitution there. So it was very ambitious. But the Privileges and Immunities Clause, after the slaughterhouse cases, is it going to be a very useful, powerful provision for protecting individual rights?
No.
Why not? Why not?
Well,
Because they read it, they interpret it only to do what?
They interpret it very narrowly. It applies to
Well, not even that, though. They interpret it even more narrowly, right? So, in particular, this clause only applies in what circumstance? Yes? Right, when you're out of state. Right. Then you can assert some rights, and then not even all the rights, right? Whatever rights that citizens of the United States would have, right? So, and in those days, people didn't travel much, right? So this was not a very useful reading. And it was intended to be a restrictive reading. Yes. Oh. You have questions? Oh. Okay. I thought you were... So yeah, looking for questions. Sorry. So, but here's the thing. This is the irony of it. So, in a very close decision, the Supreme Court says, okay, this is not going to make us a perpetual censor of the states. We're not going to get in the business of reviewing what the state does to its citizens. That's not our job, right? And so the slaughterhouse cases can be understood to stand for the proposition that we're going to read the 14th Amendment narrowly to keep the courts out of the state's business as much as possible. But the irony is that, of course, then the court, a few years later, embarks upon interpreting this last clause of the 14th Amendment very broadly in ways that require them to spend all their time measuring the actions of the states against their own citizens. And that's why this clause, therefore, becomes the most important clause in the 14th Amendment, even though it doesn't look like it. The due process clause becomes the source of all the aspirations for various natural law rights, unenumerated rights, all the rights that you wish were in the Constitution, but you don't see it in there exactly, right? This provides a vehicle by which you might be able to argue those rights should be protected. Okay. Now, let's take a quick look at it before we move forward, but this is why we call this the substantive due process doctrine. Right. So, Ms. Persaud, I know you're kind of still recovering, but just the language here, right? Just read the language here one more time for us. So, of the due process clause. Yeah, the red part. No, just stop here. So, nor shall any state deprive any citizen, person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. What does this guarantee? How can this be a source of protecting rights? Well, I mean, so the process part suggests, as we suggested earlier, when you think of process, right, what are you thinking usually of? Right, you have to go to the hearing and talk to the right people, etc. Yes? But it doesn't say deprive of liberty, it says deprive of liberty without due process. So what work does the word due process do here? That's the weird part about this, right? It would be more natural to say that it's a way the Bill of Rights are the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, right? But they managed to read that one out. Right? So but why is it so nor shall any state deprive, this is the curious part about this clause. It says you can deprive them. Okay, you can deprive them of life, liberty, and property as long as you give them due process. It doesn't say you can't deprive them of life, liberty, or property. Right? That would be, you know, a particular protection, right? Here it's saying shall not be deprived without due process, which suggests that maybe they can deprive your life, liberty, and property. Nonetheless, this clause has been, as Mr. Crystal suggests, as many of you have already suggested, this is in fact a vehicle for protecting individual rights, substantive individual rights, not just procedural ones. Not just the right to have a hearing and go argue your case, but you actually have a right not to be deprived of certain things. Okay. And so that's why this is called the substantive due process doctrine. This is becomes the main source of most of the rights and civil rights, privileges and immunities, arguably, that the 14th Amendment is going to be interpreted to protect. So on Thursday, we're going to see the court's first attempt to use, the most famous attempt to use this clause to protect substantive individual liberties, and the way it did that, and then the reason it stopped doing that.
Thank you. I'm not really